You went to the zoo.
Yeah,
went today.
I went to the zoo with Joshy and Jules.
What did you see?
We saw, oh, you know what's awesome? The elephant.
Mm.
We saw the elephant. I don't know what its name is, but
just
it's an
elephant.
Just
the one elephant.
Yeah, there's only one elephant. Well, there might be the baby elephant somewhere.
Okay.
But there's a big elephant. Anyway, it shat, and all these little girls watching started screeching because it's like big, huge dollops of shit coming out of its little bum, and also it pissed.
Probably the biggest turds on the planet, I'd
correct.
Say.
And then it pissed, and it's got the biggest...
Oh, it's a boy elephant.
Yeah.
Ah.
It's got really, a really big...
It's a large mammal.
Yeah. And they screamed at that too.
How old were they?
Well, there were lots of people at the zoo. There was lots. And the little kids went, ah! It was hilarious. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast about a mostly speculative fiction, books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. This is episode 15. My name is Ian Mond, and to my left is Kirsten McDermott. Happy Australia Day, Kirsten.
Oh, did we have to?
Well, I just thought we'd, you know, date the podcast.
It's January 26, 2012.
And in Australia, that's Australia Day. In India, it's Republic Day. Did you know that? I only know that because I've been watching the cricket.
Okay.
So it's actually an important day in India as well.
Well, happy Republic Day to our Indian listeners.
And on this very day.
If there are any.
Yes. So on this very day, Australia, not much happened. I don't know. Why is it January 26th?
Oh, my God.
did the first fleet come here on the 26th of January? Is that, what?
Nothing.
I'm not ignorant. I just, look, I went to a Jewish school. They only taught us Hebrew. That's a lie. I promise.
I think that's a lie. Yeah. I think you've managed to offend a lot of people now.
we're 15 seconds in. It's good.
Okay.
So, a couple of things before we get to the books.
Okay.
One of them is related to the books. But the first thing, yeah, you know what I'm talking about. You'll understand when I get there.
Okay.
The first thing is the idea you had, which I was horrified at, but have slowly come to understand it and appreciate it and think it could be a good idea, which is, would you like to mention your idea?
My zany idea, which I'm, the more I think about it, the more I think is possibly not a good idea.
So it's like we're swapping, like a balancing thing. Yeah.
Is that I would like to do an episode that looks at originally self-published e-books, probably not in the depth that we normally discuss a book.
In other words, if we hate it, we can stop reading it.
Well, if we hate it, we can stop reading it. But I think I'd like to actually look at and talk about the idea of self-publishing e-books. As a new author more than as an established author who you know, sidetracks or, you know,
so what
branches
about,
out into two e-books.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
What about the author that has disappeared, as there are some, so they were writing in the 80s and 90s, they've now discovered that they can publish their back catalogue via Kindle. We wouldn't look – and they're doing it on their own.
Yeah, yeah.
Penny, would we look at those guys?
I'm more interested in I guess, the phenomenon.
That was bizarre.
I'm more interested in the people who have started out publishing in ebooks and have not published in what's, I guess, the traditional publishing avenues.
Okay.
Because, yeah, there is the idea that which I don't espouse, but the idea that traditional publishing is dying, blah, 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 there won't be any need for publishers or agents or blah, 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 blah. And it's a brave new world of e-publishing and we can go straight from writer to reader, which, I mean, there's a lot of merit in the argument. I remain unconvinced by it. I guess I'd like to be convinced by some good books.
Yes, so this is the thing back to you, the listener.
Yes.
We would like you to recommend these books to us. We're not going to go find them ourselves.
No, because there's so much to trawl through.
Yes, in fact, I'd say 45% of my followers on Twitter are people who self-publish Kindle books. So I could just trawl through all my followers, but
well, we don't want recommendations from the authors themselves.
No,
that's a bit cheating.
Yeah, or a pseudonym of the author.
Or a best friend of the author, or their mother, or their dog.
We're not going to be able to vet them.
We're not going to be able to vet them. But no, so what we would like, if you have read an originally self-published ebook, and we're saying ebook because we just don't want to have to get, you know, like kilograms of paper books sent to us somehow or acquire them, because often self-published books are hard to find if they're in print format.
Yeah, because they're they're Lulu books.
Well, they're Lulu, yeah. So e-books just for e-books. Expediency, really, and also because that's kind of where the buzz is at the moment about direct author-reader relationships and publishing. So if you have read a really good e-book that's been self-published and originally self-published, we'd like to hear about it.
Is Amanda Hocking allowed?
Well, Amanda Hocking would be allowed. I mean, that she would fit the definition.
But she's now got a contract.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Amanda Hocking is a little older news now. So we kind of like, not a book that's already sort of a course celeb in itself.
What was that? Was that French? It's Australia Day, Kirsten.
Oh.
Not French Day. Do the French even have a day?
Hello, French listeners. You can lock him up in the Bastille if you can get him.
Next he'll be saying topic du jour. I love that one. Topic du jour, whatever the hell that means. Anyway, so that was
– topic of the day?
Yeah, I know what it means. I just didn't know about the straight 26th of January. So did you know that Evil and War
That's a private joke.
No, it's not. We mentioned it on the podcast like about eight episodes ago.
I think we mentioned it on your podcast.
No, it wasn't on Shooting the Poo. It was on a previous podcast.
Anyway.
Maybe it was Shooting the Poo when we did the Austin.
This is what happens when you do 10 million podcasts.
Shut up, Kirsten.
Anyway, so if you have read an originally self-published ebook that you think is rather good, send us an email.
I'll buy it.
Or comment on the blog.
I'll buy it.
I'm hoping you would be.
we're required to spend money. No one has to send us copies. That's why we're trying to cut the author out.
Yes.
We don't want authors to say, "Oh, here's a free copy of it." No, we're quite happy to put money.
Oh yeah, yeah. We'll buy the books. But we kind of like a filter because I'm quite partial to gatekeepers. So we're asking our listeners to be our gatekeepers and saying, here's a book that we've read that we really liked and we think you should talk about it. And then we will. Yes. And if we get more than five or six, we'll just have to just pick some at random.
If, however, no one has actually read a self-published e-book.
That they liked.
Then we won't do a podcast on it. So
we won't, that's right.
It's open. We'll see what comes to us.
I guess we're putting the onus of our own philosophy of this podcast onto our listeners in that we don't want you to recommend a book that you think is dreadful because you just want us to tear us apart because probably we won't finish reading it and then we won't have anything to say. So a good book. We're after good books.
Yes. On that note, one thing we haven't promoted recently since really the first episode is that we are looking for reader recommendations still.
Oh, yeah, still.
Just generally of books that they recommend and we'll do the old episode.
Oh, yep.
As long as the book isn't 985 pages long.
That was two books, so.
Yeah, well, yes. Well, and we were given a list and we picked that, so it was our fault.
We did.
But we would have had to have read it for the Hugos anyway, so I suppose it all worked out.
That was All Clear and Blackout by Connie Willis, in case listeners have not been keeping up.
They listen to every episode, all right?
We may have new people who've just listened to this first one and have not yet gone back to go through our back catalogue.
Yeah, fine. Hello, new listeners.
Hello,
that wasn't sarcastic. So my second point is connected to the first and then segues neatly into our books, which is Redemption in Indigo and Zoo City. They're the books we're doing.
Yes.
How did you read them, Kirsten?
I read them both on my tablet.
And so did I, not your tablet, my iPad. So this is probably our first podcast ever where we've both read the books completely electronically.
Both read them, yes.
Usually I've read at least one of them electronically.
Though, ironically, I did have a paperback copy of Zoo City that I'd had for quite a few months and
which
hadn't got around
now,
to reading.
Which you've now, I believe, burnt because you're now converted to the book world. So the paper thing is no longer required. Think of the trees you're saving.
No, that's not true. But I did happen to get a gratis copy of Zoo City as an ebook, so I read that as an ebook rather than the paper book because I had already read Redemption in Indigo. So
how'd you find the experience?
I like the idea of reading ebooks. I think it's really good. I do find it disappointing that most of the ones I've read so far really do have formatting errors in them. But it's early days, so I guess we're still.
But don't you expect better from major publishers? Neither. Okay, to be fair, well, small beer and
is
angry,
a small press.
Angry Robot are
and
both.
So is Angry Robot.
Small presses. So, and yeah, they don't probably have the resources.
Although,
I
Angry
didn't have
Robot.
The same problems you did on your program. I thought the small beer one was beautifully done.
Okay.
The Zoo City, yeah, I also saw hanging.
There were line breaks where line they shouldn't breaks, be. There were,
but not too bad. Not as bad as.
And some font issues when there were. Where text was broken up into segments of italics. There were some line break and spacing issues with those bits when she's kind of dreaming and.
I remember yeah, the episode of Galactic Suburbia where Elisa talks about at length how hard it is to take the 12th Planet catalogue.
Oh, yeah.
And using Charles Tan when he's got the time to convert the yeah, books to EPUB or Mobi.
Because
or whatever,
there's all different formats and yeah, you've got to make sure they work in all different formats.
And it's very difficult. And if you don't have the resources, I mean, you can do it at home using Calibre. Have you used Calibre yet?
No, I haven't had the need to yet.
Yeah, but there'll be days. And, for example, turning a basic PDF into an EPUB or Mobi can be done, but you're going to get rubbish. You get a lot yeah, of hanging sentences, paragraphs that don't – just all sorts of problems.
Oh,
gaps
yeah, I know,
in
I know.
Words.
I've transferred just Word documents into EPUB and they don't often translate all that well.
No. So Calibre is actually really good as a translation software, but it's limited to what yep, it can do. You still have to do a lot of manual work, which is not yeah, really a lot of fun if you haven't actually read the book. So if you got the book and
well,
you want to convert
yeah,
it.
I wouldn't do it. No, I just get the format that I want to.
No, but people do.
I know.
Especially if they're trying to rip the DRM off the
yeah,
off the Kindle book.
I'm not a huge
not
fan
that
of
I do
DRM.
That. I don't do
which
that,
is why I didn't get a Kindle.
Yeah, you didn't get a Kindle. You got no, a – what is it? What tablet's that?
It's an Acer.
It really looks very nice. I mean,
it's a lovely tablet. I really am very happy with it.
I wouldn't give up my iPad for quits. But
I've read a lot of stuff on this thing in the couple of months that I've had it because I read a lot of the Aurealis and Australian Shadows submissions on it. We got a lot of short fiction as a PDF or Word document. So I read a lot on that tablet and it was very convenient.
So now that you've done it, you've written two novels that on the apart from the Aurealis stuff.
I've read two novels on it.
Yeah.
Not written.
I said read. Didn't I say read?
You said written.
Did I say written? Oh. Yeah, now that you've done that.
Yes.
Are you converted? Well, I know you're converted, but do you think this year you're going to read more e-stuff than hard copy? Because I think I am.
Do you? Well, listeners won't be able to see this, but Ian, if you look to my left,
yes,
do you see those three big piles of books yeah, there? They're my to be read pile.
It's about 35 books.
So I'll probably be reading through most of those this year.
I'd say a percentage of those are online to be bought or.
But I've already got them.
Yeah, but you already had Zoo City.
Yeah,
too.
But I got the ebook for free because it was
yeah, but
part
you had
of
Zoo
the...
City as well. No, but it might be more convenient to read an e-version of one of those books than to actually read.
Yeah, but I wouldn't go and spend more money on an e-version of a book I've already got. I wouldn't have got the ebook of Zoo City. It was just a freebie.
No, it says you have to spend money. Da 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 da. What could he mean? What?
Yes. Where's my stick?
Yeah, apparently, it's a penguin.
So this year, I think I'll be buying a lot more ebooks. But I'm going to still be buying print books. I'm a big fan of the book as artifact. I think I will be probably anything I would have normally have bought as a cheap mass market paperback. I probably would buy as an ebook if it's available.
You know, what's interesting with ebooks, I buy a lot. And they vary in price. You can get them from $1 to $9.99 and some a bit more expensive. But you know what I've started doing a lot more? Buying secondhand books on Advanced Book Exchange. I don't know why.
Oh, secondhand paper books.
Yeah, I don't understand how that works. I've gone from buying everything new and pristine,
yeah,
Odd Book Depository or whatever, to basically buying nearly everything as an ebook, and now I've transferred to secondhand books on ABE.
Okay. For older books that aren't available in e-format.
Yes. Yes, sorry about the coughs.
Okay. Well, I mean, that sounds to me like you've bypassed the idea of book as artifact and you're just after the medium, the cheapest medium.
Yes, because you know what I do? Even if it's available as a book, I now do a check, see if I can get it cheaper as a secondhand book.
Yeah, so you're just after the words that are in
yeah,
whatever
I
medium
am.
It is.
I like a beautiful book. Who doesn't?
Yeah.
But, yeah, there is a bit of that. I don't know. Anyway, it's just interesting changing out. What I'm trying to say, though, is that the ebook hasn't negated for me the need to buy the book as a physical object, even though you're right, it's not for the physical. It's just there's a cheap that's the element there. Now I'm saying like I'm stingy.
No, I mean, when you buy as many books as we do, I mean, price does become a factor. Someone who buys half a dozen books a year, whether that book costs $20 or $10, if you're only buying half a dozen books a year, it doesn't add up to a significant amount of money. If you're buying 100 books a year, suddenly, you know, a $10 price differential per title is $1,000.
You're right. It's massive. And I've got to say also the convenience, everyone talks about convenience, but it's genuine. The Kindle one, I can get the book within 15 seconds of someone recommending it.
It's not always a good thing.
No, it isn't, but I only get the ones that are recommended by people I trust.
Yeah.
And people want to know that they can check out my blog because I rated a whole bunch of reviewers who I think are worth reading. But anyway, that's just, you know, plugging my blog.
Sorry. Keep going.
One of the books you're going to recommend to me, the book you're recommending me for next month, which we won't mention till the end of the podcast.
Yep.
To keep, you know, some sense of suspense. Do you know, I couldn't get it.
You couldn't get it as an e-book?
Couldn't get it. Well, there is an e-book of it. Sort of, okay. By some sort of Google Books thing on one of the Aussie websites. But when I did a bit of research on how that comes out, it didn't look very good. So
okay.
I didn't want to get that. I couldn't be bothered getting it online for some reason. I just don't know why.
So you went into a bookstore?
Three. It took three bookstores to find it.
Yeah.
No, four, sorry, which was really annoying.
Unfortunately, it doesn't surprise me.
But it's annoying.
It is annoying, but this isn't what book buying used to be like.
Yeah, but it's
you'd
not
go
that
into
anymore.
A bookshop,
I forgot
it wouldn't
about
be
it.
There. You'd have to order it in, and it'd take a few weeks.
I forgot about how annoying that is.
Yeah,
By the way, readings on Glen Ferry Road, the second one, the one towards Kew, is fantastic.
I don't think I've been to that one. No, I have not been to that one, not in Hawthorne. Okay. I'm a huge fan of e-books. I don't think they'll replace print books for a long, long time for various reasons. I think you'll have extremists in both camps. I was actually talking to some people about this last night. You'll have people who will just say, I will never read an e-book. I like paper. I like the books. It's a thing. I don't want to buy the device. They're all different. The formats are, you know, the things will change in 10 years and then I'll lose my whole library and I'll never read an e-book. That's it. Done. On paper books only until they or me die. And then you have the other camp who's just saying, oh, e-books are amazing and that's it. No more paper books and I'm getting rid of all my paper books and replacing them with e-copies and if a book isn't available as an e-copy, I just won't read it. And that's their extremist views on both ends of the scale.
Wow, it's amazing the humans have extremist views.
I know,
but
I think the vast majority of people will be in the middle. They'll read some e-books and they'll continue to buy some print books. And some print books they own, they may get rid of.
But I can't believe I went back to ABE. The last book I bought on ABE was like 5 years ago.
I buy from them all the time for older out-of-print books.
Yes, but you're not me. Shocked that is. And I didn't know I'd go back. I thought I was stuck I was happy to be there.
Yeah.
I didn't think I'd start to move towards, and you say I'm looking for the cheaper book. I admit there is that element of stingy, but I didn't expect that. But some authors, like, for example, I liked the interview Coot Street had with Elizabeth Hand.
I thought it was a really good
interview. So I immediately went and bought Generation Loss.
Yep.
But I bought it secondhand, so Elizabeth doesn't actually get any money from that. But
that's not a problem. She did, though, at one point.
Yeah, at one point, yeah. I didn't steal it or anything. It's, you know, legal. But, that's because her back catalogue isn't on ebook.
Yep.
So I don't know what point I was trying to make. Probably not at all. So let's not ramble then. Let's get straight into that.
I think we are rambling, Gary.
Yeah. That's great. That was brilliant.
So what did you recommend for me on the podcast this month?
I recommended the last book that I'm going to recommend without actually having read the book first.
Okay.
Because next month I've read it already. I recommended Redemption in Indigo by Karen Lord. What did you recommend for me?
We'll get to that later.
I think people know. Okay, fine. Can I start?
You can start.
I'll get to this in a second. Do we have to do did either of us have the actual physical copy of the book?
I do not, because I bought it as an e-book from Small
Beer.
Yeah,
so did I.
But I did.
Did you print out the
blurb? I did print out a blurb from Small Beer. So I'll just read that quickly. Okay. Karen Lord's debut novel is an intricately woven tale of adventure, magic, and the power of the human spirit. Palmer's husband is a fool and a glutton, bad enough that he followed her to her parents' home in the village of Makenda. Now he's disgraced himself by murdering livestock and stealing corn. It's actually very funny when you read the book.
It's making me laugh now.
When Palmer leaves him for good, she attracts the attention of the Undying Ones, the Jombi, who present her with a gift, the Chaos Stick, which allows her to manipulate the subtle forces of the world. Unfortunately, a wrathful Jombi with indigo skin believes his power should be his and his alone.
That's actually a pretty good description of the book.
It's pretty good. It's a nice little capsule, I guess, synopsis.
Here's my thinking, and I might be wrong. If this book had to go through a workshop at... Now, I've never done MFA or... Obviously, I haven't done MFA. I'm in Australia, but sort of
workshops... You haven't done any creative writing workshops or courses, or anything like that?
But if this book had have come to one of those sort of workshops...
I think it would have been slaughtered.
It would have been slaughtered, wouldn't it?
Entrails left out in the desert sun.
Because it doesn't actually have a consistent focus throughout... And this is one of its pluses, not its negatives. It doesn't have a consistent focus. I mean, it's being told by a storyteller.
Yes.
So, and we're told that from the very beginning. This is someone telling us a story.
Yep.
This person, and I think it's a he, because I think we meet him later on in the book. I think it's the same person, because we meet a storyteller.
I don't think it's that storyteller, because that storyteller tells the story to the person who's telling this story.
No, but, well, that might be part of the meta of the book.
No, though. I don't think so.
No, okay. Well, whether it's a he or she, irrelevant. It could be Karen Lord. I mean, it's Karen Lord telling us a story, in a sense.
Yeah.
And, well, not in a sense, she is. She's written the bloody book. It's not a sense. It's Karen Lord telling us a story. And it doesn't focus. It's amazing. It starts with the story of Palmer and Ansinge, her husband, who she's left, who's come to visit her. That's hilarious.
It is. The book is really funny.
It is extremely funny.
I was laughing out loud in some parts.
I didn't wear my pants, but I got close a few times. That first 40, 50 pages, whatever it is absolutely a laugh out loud.
And that beginning bit with the three phases of that story, that's the actual folktale from Senegal that...
Oh, I guess I didn't do any of that research. So
yeah.
So that actually has basis in a genuine folktale.
That's kind of the folktale, a wife who gets rid of her husband. And so that's sort of the form of the folktale. So everything after that is new.
Okay, because that's literally just the launching pad.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was wondering as I was reading this first and laughing, these first 30, 40 pages, I thought, well, how's she going to pull this out for longer? I mean, where's the, you know, what's going to happen? Is Ansinga going to, I don't know, be possessed and become evil or things... Pock. He's got through your mind. But he basically disappears.
He goes back home.
Well, yeah.
Because she says, look, I'm sick of you, go home.
The camera,
that is
the storyteller, moves, depending on where the story is. And the story doesn't stay in the same spot. Palmer is consistently mostly throughout the... But even she isn't in the story for its whole 225 pages. Even she sort of becomes
the story moves around her. Like you get to see some scenes that she's not in, but it's still about her story.
Yeah, but
there's no subplot, characters doing their own thing.
No, that's my point. It's not like there's a bunch of the seven point of view characters and they're all relating back to the same plot. You have Palmer, who is your main character.
She's a protagonist.
She's your protagonist, but there are parts of the novel where she basically has no proactive element in it because it's focusing on the indigo. The indigo man, or it's focusing on the tracker, or it's focusing on the spider, or it's focusing just on something else that's interesting within this story. And that's where I think the MFA creative writing people will go, oh, no, you've got to tighten it, you've got to bring it back to Palmer, bring it back to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
But dismissed it completely.
No, I'm not dismissing it. I mean, look, I've obviously not done an MFA degree either.
You got to do those in America, don't you?
Well,
what does the MFA actually say?
Master of Fiction, Fictive Arts, Fictive Art or Fiction Arts.
Someone's telling us right now, but we can't hear.
Yeah, but I've done my fair share of workshops and critique groups and tertiary creative writing courses, and they're often these things, unless you go to a specifically genre-focused course or workshop, genre often gets left out in the cold.
Yeah, but I don't think it's the genre element that's why it would be ripped to shreds. I think if this was done at a genre workshop, it would also get
Oh, yeah, possibly.
Eviscerated. I don't think that's what saves it. I think that, for example, when the Palmer sister is going to be married to the poet,
yes,
who's been who's been who's been employed by the Indigo Man, and all that shenanigans is going on. Palmer's very is only peripherally involved in that, and that's a good chunk of the middle of the book.
Yeah,
that stuff. So that's what I'm saying. It's as if that's a separate story within amongst a number of stories.
But that's the same story because it's relating back to.
I know it's not like she's, the story suddenly goes into outer space and there's a big space fight. I'm not saying that.
No, I'm just saying like everything is still revolved around this central story of Palmer and the Chaos Stick, and how she came to got it, to get it, and what she does with it, and how the Indigo Lord. Tries to get it from her and how the story resolves itself. It's just that you get the different sides of the other actors in that story. You kind of get their stories.
That's what I found
well.
Refreshing. And that's what the point I'm trying to make. I found it really interesting that, yes, it's got a clean spine. It's clear what the A point and B point is of the book, but that it's quite happy to go elsewhere. And in fact, the Singy stuff at the beginning.
Yeah.
Really isn't that relevant to the chaos. It is in a sense because it allows the lesser deities to figure out whether Palmer is worthy of the stick. That's the idea of that first 30 or 40 pages. But you could have sort of, if you wanted to, which I'm glad Karen Law didn't, if you were ripping this a shred from a workshop perspective, you could sort of cut that stuff. Because there's a number of episodes. There's the bit with the corn, bit with the livestock, bit with the well. Is there a bit with the well?
Yeah.
And I know they're based on, and now you've told me, because I didn't know this until you told me, I know they're now based on the Senegalese folktale, but still what I'm trying to say is that we've become so beholden to structure in the way we write that's what makes this so refreshing and wonderful and beautiful and great to read, because it doesn't necessarily need to hold to a specific structure.
Yeah, no, I mean, Well, it has its own structure. I mean, but it's not a mess all over the place.
No, I'm not saying either. I'm trying not to say that. Does it sound like I'm saying that? Listener, it is not a mess all over the place.
No.
It's all done for a reason, but.
Yeah.
Even though it's quite a short book, you could see someone saying, well, this actually could be a short story, or this could be a small novella. It doesn't need to be as long as it is because there's all this peripheral stuff going on. Which isn't peripheral but feels peripheral in a sense, but it's great. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's wonderful. It should be kept. It's fantastic. There should be more books like this. Can I make that clear?
Why is it
when I talk to you, I have all these thoughts all beautifully in my mind when I'm coming here, driving here, and I look at you and you just reduce me to gibberish. What is it with you?
I have no idea.
It's that stick. Well, it used to be the stick.
I don't even have the stick.
No. What were you going to say, Kirsten?
One of the things I found, and I think – when you talk about workshopping stories, and there is merit in workshops, and I'm in a critique group and I get value from it. But, you know, it can also be quite damaging to a writer's voice, to the way the writer has a vision of their story. And one of the things I think, because I've seen it picked on in the past in various forms, in published and unpublished work, is the idea that this story doesn't really have a clear antagonist.
No, that was my next.
You know,
point.
There is. I mean, you've got the Indigo Lord, who is. Like he's in opposition to Palmer in that he wants the chaos stick she's been
minutes.
Given. Yeah, but he's in opposition to her because he wants the stick she's been given. That's sort of the bone of contention.
Yeah, but Karen Lord undermines all that by Palmer basically saying when they first meet, you can have it. Oh, shit, I can't give it to you. We'll have to sort that out, but you can have it. It's not like there's some quest you have to hide it from you or like your normal fantasy thing where it would be daggers and
And he's not a villain in the way that we would frame. And part of that is that we do get his side of the story.
Yes.
So he's not this major antagonist that a lot of fiction is deemed necessary to have. If you don't have a clear antagonist who's opposing the protagonist at every turn and providing a contrast and conflict, then it's a boring book. One of the things Redemption in Indigo does is proves that you don't have to have a boring book an antagonist.
And it's funny because the storyteller tells you this is our villain. Actually says
yeah.
And it's an absolute joke on the reader.
I mean, it's a wonderful narrative voice. It's really playful,
yeah,
and sardonic at times, and
but it's tongue in cheek saying this is the villain.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, knowing full well that really he's only the villain for about a minute.
Yeah. He's only the villain in that his desires are, at least at the beginning, opposed to what you think Palmer's story is going to be.
Yeah, but you set up with a prejudice about this character.
Yeah.
Which is what the storyteller does. Then you see he's manipulating people around him and you think, well, he's evil, so he's going to kill or maim people, but he doesn't. And then by the time Palmer comes in the scene and they meet, it's diffused completely by the fact that she's quite happy to give him what he wants. Within minutes of meeting.
It's like, okay, have it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why I have this. Yeah, oh, I've saved a few people, whatever. Oh, yeah, whatever. Here, take it. And then can't give it to him for reasons that is made clear in the book. And then they have to sort. And that's then the villain of the piece, in a sense, becomes fate and the nature of the stick
fate
itself.
Fate and chaos itself and the forces of reality,
right.
I guess.
That was the best bit about the book.
And it's really good because
that
you don't need an antagonist with a capital A. You need your characters to run up against obstacles and so things don't always go their way and all of that. That you need that in a book. You need some kind of conflict. And by conflict, I don't mean, you know, brandishing of swords and fisticuffs or anything, but you need a conflict in your narrative between what your main characters want or need or desire and what's stopping them from getting that. You need that. And often the easiest way to do that is to throw in a villain. Who's stopping them doing it? I mean, that's very clearly a point of conflict and so on, and can be literal conflict a lot of the time. But you don't need an antagonist.
But I thought
such.
That was what literary fiction was all about. It doesn't have antagonists normally. It's usually life that's the antagonist, and that's why it's literary fiction. And, you know, I mean, genre fiction doesn't play that game.
Yeah. Generally, well, I mean, that's
99.9%.
That's quite a simplistic definition of both genres.
I'm just trying to stir the pot for the sake of the
book. Well, instead of literary fiction, let's use the word mimetic fiction, because that's one that I'm
on a reader a list. It's a Doctor Who one, but anyway, irrelevant. Okay. Where someone used the term mimetic fiction and it started a flame war.
How did it start a flame war?
Oh, but only pretentious people use the term mimetic fiction and it's the sign of superiority over inferiority and I don't know. I actually stopped reading it after a while. It was hilarious.
Wow.
To begin with. So please keep going, mimetic fiction. this is true.
Well, with apologies to everyone who now feels looked down upon.
On the Doctor Who list.
On the Doctor Who list.
Yeah.
Don't like the new Doctor. Just thought I'd throw that in while I'm making enemies. No, and it's not Matt Smith. I don't like the characterization of the new Doctor.
Yeah, you're wrong. Anyway, keep going.
Well, I'm finding myself preferring the term mimetic fiction rather than literary fiction. Literary fiction is sort of a genre unto itself anyway, and then, yeah. The arguments are there for that, but if you try, you can't really separate when you get down to fuzzy borders, literary fiction and genre fiction, because there'll be some, you know, supposedly or so-called genre fiction that is hailed by some people to be so well written it can't possibly be genre.
Like
it's got to be literary fiction.
Like this.
I guess like Redemption Indigo. And then you'll have literary fiction that uses genre elements, and it's really problematic to try and define literary fiction versus genre when literary fiction is a genre in and of itself. But if you talk about mimetic fiction instead of fantastic fiction, so where mimetic fiction resembles real life as we know it in every respect, so you can't have fantastical elements, you can't have you know, what we term, and I know some people don't like the term, but speculative elements.
Yes.
And then you have the other fiction, fantastic fiction, speculative fiction, whatever you want to call it, which can run the gamut from you know, a high alternate world fantasy with completely non-human characters and not our universe world, to something like, I guess, like Zoo City, which we'll get to later, that is just pretty much our world, just tweaked a bit.
Yeah,
I mean, that's kind of the whole gamut of non-mimetic fiction.
Yeah.
Whereas mimetic fiction is simply that which you know, it replicates what we know to be the world around us, how people act in the world, the physical properties that govern the world, all of that sort of stuff.
But this book couldn't be as far from that, and yet would be...
Well, that's why it breaks down the whole literary genre divide, because there is no such divide. Okay. It's merely, you're merely talking about content. And I'm quite happy with people say, I only like mimetic fiction.
Yeah, but no one actually says that in part.
Well, they don't say mimetic fiction. What they say is, I don't like science fiction, I don't like fantasy, I like realist fiction. And, you know, realist fiction to me has as much problems about the word as because there's, I mean, it's all fiction. It's all fiction. It's all made up. People say, I don't like reading about made up words, worlds and people. It's like, really? What, do you read any novels? I mean, they're all made up worlds and people. It's just some, you know, are constructed to resemble our reality and others are not. So mimetic is simply a descriptor of content.
How did we get onto this?
I have no idea. No,
that was really interesting.
You just stepped me off on a segue about.
I love how it's always
talking about mimetic fiction. I don't know what I was about to say when you went into the whole Doctor Who flame war thing.
Well, let's go back a step then, back to the book even.
Back to the
which
book,
could be a shock.
Yes,
is this fantasy or is this science fiction? There, I've now gone and taken your complicated discussion on mimetic and turned it into a is this one thing or is this another discussion?
I'm
because it talks about quantum physics. Yeah, in look. The book.
I am...
you over that debate too?
Really over that debate. I think that's why as... Words are what... The definitions of words are as we make them to be. And definitions change over time. And I'm quite happy with the umbrella term speculative fiction. And yes, I'm well aware of the arguments that all fiction is in some sense speculative because it's not real and people are speculating about blah. But I'm happy to accept the definition... Of speculative fiction as being that which is opposed to, and not in an antagonistic way, just as in contrast.
That's the definition.
To mimesis. So and that's all we need. And then it doesn't matter if it's science fiction or fantasy.
But you weren't allowed to break those rules 20 years ago. And Karen Lord not only breaks the rules of not having a defined antagonist, not necessarily having a spine of a story, but not really keeping to it 100%. She also has a chaos stick, which may be a fantastical object or maybe a science fiction object, because the gods that surrounded the Jumbo could potentially be science fiction-y sort of entities or fantastical entities. She doesn't make it clear enough. How dare she?
Well, this is the thing. I think this is one of the really great and interesting things that's happening in non-mimetic fiction at the moment.
Oh, my God. Non-mimetic?
Non-mimetic. Oh,
for a second, I thought you'd made a new term.
No, I haven't made a new term.
Chuck a Neo in front of it. That always sounds
Neo
good.
Neo-non-mimetic.
Neo-non-mimetic fiction.
Esque.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Anyway, it's one of the really good things about it is that it is blurring boundaries and because, I mean, you know, people talk about how science fiction is difficult to write because we live in a science fictional world and the future changes every day and blah, blah, blah. And so a lot of the trappings of William Gibson's latest suite of books, the Blue Ant sort of
books. Yeah, Pattern Thingamajig and
Pattern Recognition.
Zero History.
I mean, are they... science fiction
them,
or
so
are they alternate present or are they just 5 minutes away?
I haven't
books?
Read them, so I wouldn't know.
It kind of blurs the line. So, and I like the idea that we don't have to have, and some people I know push back against it a lot, but I really like the idea that we don't have to have these really strict genre boundaries, and a book can have a bit of fantasy and a bit of science fiction and a bit of horror and a bit of noir and all these things that are just kind of mixed up together.
And Karen makes it work?
I think Karen Lord definitely makes it work. And, I mean, she's also drawing on sort of mythic territory, which underpins her book.
Yeah, see, and this is where I get a bit uncomfortable as a white person who's Jewish. Well, no, because I say Jewish because there's a folklore fable aspect to the book. And it reminded me very much of my own traditions and Midrash, which is the fables and folklore of Judaism, which are often biblical. The fact they are biblical, this isn't biblical specifically, but usually so. For example,
in Judaism, you'll have in the Bible, it's Moses with the sea, and then there'll be a midrash connected to that, which will give you a sort of explanation. It will give you a sort of secondary perspective on that story of what that meant, Moses splitting the sea. And usually, it focuses on what happened to the Pharaoh's soldiers and how they drowned and whatever. That's how midrash works. But when I was reading the book, it felt very akin to my own traditions. But I'm very much uncomfortable with the idea of trying to make this seem exotic. That, Caribbean, African, whatever, however you want to look at it, sort of storytelling, and it's all very exotic, and aren't we lucky to be reading it? And
We've said exotic.
No, I'm not saying you. I'm not saying me. I'm saying I'm trying to, because there is that feeling that when you read something as new and as refreshing as this, that you can say, ooh, it's this lovely new thing, and it's of its culture as well. But you're giving me that look. See, this is what we should do. I'm now saying we should do these things on Skype.
So I don't look at you.
Yeah, with that weird, what the fuck are you going
Maybe
about?
We could set up a screen between us. So, with a little pigeonhole, I can just slide across and glare at you every now and then.
I'm not trying to say that
the truth of the matter is that for you, it actually is exotic. It is an exotic experience.
It is, but I don't want to say that's what excited me, that it's entirely because it's an exotic experience. I've been given this peephole into a different culture, that's what excited me, because I'm Mr. White Man, and wow, I haven't seen that before.
But you haven't seen that before.
No, but
so
I also
that's
want
really
to,
cool.
But I also want to say that Karen Lord's looking at the universality of storytelling, that I'm attracted to this because it's a universal thing. It isn't just because it's specifically Caribbean or based around her culture. But yes, the story itself, and I didn't know it was a Sinhalese folklore, well, the basis of it. Yeah, that is that exotic element. But
I'm not meaning to look at you. I'm sorry.
No, you can look at me. Just don't do that face.
I don't know what face I'm doing. I'm sorry.
That's better.
Okay.
So explain what I'm trying to say.
I don't know what you're trying to say.
No.
Yeah, you're trying – what you don't want to – you don't want to too heavily link the fact that this is a story set in a culture not your own, written by a person from a culture not your own, and you don't want to link that to, I guess, irrevocably with your enjoyment of the story and say that, oh, it's just because it's written by a – you know, a writer from Barbados, and it's about setting in a different culture, and it's all folk tales, and I've never come across it before, and that's what, and this is how these people write. That's not what you're saying. You're saying this is how these people write.
Correct. That's a summary of it. Yes.
Yeah. Which I mean, it is valid, and it's
which is a form of tokenism to me.
Yeah, it is. But you're not doing that.
No, I'm not. But that's why, the moment we've spoken for what, half an hour on this book, and we really haven't spoken about the cultural side to it, and that's because I'm uncomfortable, because I don't want it to make it sound like it's a form of tokenism. Because I want to talk. That's why I started by talking about how it does diverge in the ways it diverges, and how it would be ripped apart if it went to a creative writing course.
But at the same point,
this than it probably is. I'm sorry.
I understand your oversensitivity, but at the same time, it's really. It's important to acknowledge that this is a different cultural product. I mean, this is the whole point. This is the whole point of reading outside of your own cultural group, whether that's, gender or race or sexuality or social differences. The whole point is to read outside of the identity that you have. So to get points of view and world experiences and perceptions of the way people are that are not just you and your friends.
Yeah, I accept that.
And that's why, we make a big deal, or a lot of people quite rightly make a big deal of explicitly trying to read books outside their gender, outside their race, outside their language, if they can get them in translation, which is a bit of a problem sometimes, to get this difference, this different lens. And, I mean, the beautiful thing is really that we are just all humans.
Well,
so, our stories, when told well, are going to have a universality to them.
Yeah, okay.
Because they're human stories.
And what I'm trying to say,
but
is I don't want
the differences in the storytelling and in the perspectives and in the characters that that gives, you know, this beauty to the literary landscape.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that it's not just because it's exotic and different and completely different to the culture that I'm aware of, that's why it's great. It's brilliant for those reasons. It's brilliant because it's just really well written, a wonderful, it's refreshing, it's innovative. It could be about any culture to a degree.
No.
Possibly.
I think you're going too far.
Yes, that's the problem, isn't it? Because to try and move away from a certain position, you go too far in another position.
You do. And then
you come out sounding racist. So in a sense, you just say, well, you could just whitewash all the characters and it could just be the other story.
They could just be white and set in Boston.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
When they quite patently couldn't be.
I'm new to this. When it comes to the feminist side, which I'll get to in a second, and it comes to that because there's one thing I want to read out from the book, and it comes to the cultural appropriation side. This stuff is very new to me, so I do think of these things. I probably should.
Really, it's actually just easy. It's just, it basically just comes down to respect, and I think where people, I know with the internet, it's really hard because sometimes it feels like if you say one thing and you get it wrong, you'll be jumped on by the whole world and you'll have to run away in a corner and never speak to anyone again. And that's a really – and I've seen it happen on the internet and it can be really horrible. But mostly what inspires those kinds of flame wars and things that end up being dog piles and so on is that the person who originally said something which was a bit insensitive or patently wrong in some cases, instead of coming back and going, oh, okay, I didn't realise that was the case, let me have a think about that some more, they've come back and gone, well, no, I'm right and you're all wrong and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And it's that attitude that usually inspires the kind of vitriol that you get on the internet. It's not necessarily the initial thing that was said or intimated. It's the reaction of the person who said it and their refusal to respect the opinions of others who disagree with them and their refusal to admit that they actually might be mistaken or need to think about something a bit more or need to look at another source. And that's the problem. Okay. I think
so I can relax.
We should be less afraid to make mistakes when we're talking about things, especially sensitive things, because it's only through talking about things and making mistakes and being corrected about our perceptions that we learn.
Okay. That's
you know, if we're all too afraid to say anything, then we'll never get corrected on our perceptions.
Yeah, but I can't.
So, I'm guilty of it
I wasn't aware that I was in a station of privilege until I was told. I know it's common sense. I know if I just think about it for 5 seconds.
It's not common sense, actually.
Well, apparently it's meant to be. It's apparently if you self-reflect for about a minute, you should know that your position in society.
No, because common sense is actually that you you know, the common sense is that you don't think about it. I mean, that's what it is. But this is the thing. I mean, if you get something pointed out to that that your way of thinking isn't completely correct and there are other ways of viewing an issue, or if something you've said is factually wrong, or something that you said maybe is factually right, but you've said it in a way that's hurt people. I mean, all of that is okay with me. That's all fine. To an extent, you know, obviously people who jump up and down on the internet and say we should kill all black people, that they're just, no, they don't get a second chance. But I think making mistakes when you're talking about complicated issues like people's identity and what people care about and how people perceive the world, you're allowed to make mistakes on that. What you're not allowed to do is dig your feet in and say, no, no, I'm right.
Okay.
And I don't have to listen to anybody because my point of view is the right one.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to this is a real shit stir question. And I want to tie it back to the book.
And the other thing you have to do is not deliberately shit stir.
Yeah. Well, this is a deliberate shit stir right now. So I am deliberately doing it. If it wasn't Karen Lord who wrote this, knowing her cultural background, if it was Ian Mond who'd written this, written this book, and I'd be proud to. Though, wouldn't there be real issues? Possibly. This is something I've also been thinking about for some time.
If you wrote
because this is a genuine. This feels like a genuine piece of work. This is someone who's obviously aware of the folk tales of a culture, and I don't know.
But
even know
she's not from Senegal.
No, she's not from Senegal. So that's the other thing.
She's from Barbados, and she lives in Barbados.
And I was going to ask because see, that's where I make a fool of myself because I don't know that area.
And
she's
made up her own story after that, anyway.
Yeah, well,
but I
this concept of authenticity, this feels authentic to me. Yeah. But what does that actually mean? I mean, Karen's Lord is not from Senegal and she's gone and made up the last two thirds. So is it authentic because she just happens to live where other black people live?
No.
And she is, you know, I'm not trying to be racist. I'm trying to say this
It does feel authentic because the voice.
Well, the same discussion for Zoo City.
Yeah, the voice is authentic.
Absolutely. But if it was Ian Mon Caulfield who written it.
No, but the voice is authentic. Now, the error that can be made is saying that this voice feels authentic, the characters feel authentic in that I feel like they're real people. I feel like I could sit down in a room with them and have tea and talk about things and they feel real to me and the voice is authentic and it doesn't trip up and I don't turn the page and go, oh, that doesn't sound like what that character would think or say. And that authenticity has nothing to do when it comes right down to it with the base culture that the stories come from. That's all to do with how skilled a storyteller is. And the error that you can make is saying this book feels really authentic. This is how people from Senegal must be. And that's the leap that is wrong to make. So talking about
About the Wind-Up Girl, written by Badger Galupi,
yes,
and saying, well, that's authentic and that's what people like Thailand in that particular circumstance in the future. But I mean,
this must be what Thai culture is like.
Yeah.
This is how Thai culture will develop in the future. This is what Thai people are like.
Yeah.
That's the extra leap that you make.
Okay.
That's unnecessary when talking about the authenticity of voice. Now, it's different if it's a book that is quite distinctly about a particular place and time that is known, not a made-up place and time, but a particular place and time that is known. And then you can talk about the authenticity of the representation of that place.
Okay, so it doesn't matter. Are you also saying it doesn't matter if Ian Mond was the name on the book?
No, it doesn't matter. I mean, I don't really subscribe to a lot of the appropriation phobias. I think,
wow,
again,
so you've said something that's controversial now. Thank God, because I've said about five things. You've now said one.
I think, again, it comes down to respect. It really does. Okay. It comes down to respect. And I think you can take inspiration and resources from cultures that aren't your own. I mean, my God, if I only ever wrote about people me.
Yeah, I know. I've heard that argument. But it doesn't mean that it's not fucking difficult to do this. And as I said,
it is difficult to do it. It is difficult to do it with respect.
I knew she was from Barbados.
Yeah.
I didn't know what the original – I knew that – obviously I'm reading a fable / folk tale here. Had no idea that there were antecedents to it and that they were based in Senegal. As far as I'm concerned reading it, it's an authentic representation of her culture, of her specific culture, of Karen Lord's culture, not of the Barbados or whatever, of her culture. Now, I don't know that.
But you don't know anything about Karen Lord.
No, but then why should I necessarily need to know anything about Karen Lord?
Well, to make the leap,
yeah, you're
and
right.
To say that this book then represents Karen Lord, yeah, that's a big leap. And that's the mistaken leap,
okay,
because I don't think you'd make that leap if you're reading a book by Ian MacDonald.
Yeah, because I mean, when we read,
you know, or China Mieville, or,
well, when we read Who Fears Death, the Nnedi Okorafor book, and I think that was her,
yeah,
cultural background,
partially her cultural,
partially,
background. Yeah.
And people from it was a Nigeria. I don't know where was it originally? The story was
Sudan.
Yeah, the people from the Sudan were really upset with some of the representations, even though she has probably a closer connect. Well, she has a connection to the Sudan.
Yeah. And this is the problem. You will always.
So you can never please anyone.
You can never please everyone. And I think, again, look, it just comes down to respect. It comes down to not pillaging a culture.
Well,
there's a difference between being inspired by, you know, a culture that's or an identity that's not your own, and wanting to use that in work and pillaging it and saying, you know, and it's...
Because I read a short story just because of the last short story. I just read, I know I interrupted you,
yep,
but I read a short story just recently, which I won't mention, which basically was generic Asian culture slapped on an alien race.
Ah, oh, nice.
Yeah, that old thing. And I thought, well, haven't we seen this a million times before? That to me is overt appropriation and...
Yeah, because
no real,
because there's not a lot of respect there, and that's sort of a fetishization of a culture.
Yeah, okay.
And you know, and that's a, I mean, look, it's a really difficult thing to navigate. And again, it comes down to if you make a mistake, you own up to it.
Okay.
And you say, yeah, actually, that was kind of crap.
So it feels like we've spoken about
I could have researched that a bit better or, yeah, that wasn't on Wikipedia.
It feels like we've spoken about an hour about this book but actually said nothing about the actual book, other than the fact that we love it. I did want to talk a bit about Palm
yes.
because she is the main character. She's interesting from a from a feminist perspective and just get enter a whole other area of pain in that she does a couple of things, one main thing that you would think from a feminist perspective is not good.
What's that?
Well, she goes back to the town where Unsinghi is. He's dying of consumption or something.
Yep.
He's rooted. He's lost all his money. No one will look after
him.
Yeah,
he's about to die in a couple of days.
Because he's a dick.
He's eaten himself to death.
Basically eaten himself to death.
Not eaten himself.
No.
Gorged himself to death.
Yes. Now, I don't know, again, I speak completely without knowledge, as normal on this podcast. She decides, even though she doesn't really like them, well, she hates the man.
Oh, she doesn't hate him.
Hate's a strong word.
She's disgusted by him and she's frustrated by him and she doesn't want to be his wife and she doesn't want to have to cook for him for the rest of her life.
But she's willing to sit with him for 3 or 4 days.
Well, he's about to die.
No, but no one else is. Everyone else has left him. His servants.
Yeah.
If there's no money, you know, there's a lawyer. And it's actually quite sad but funny, the whole aspect of it.
Yeah.
There are lawyers coming in and out because they're trying to sell all his property, et cetera.
Because he's in debt.
Yeah. She's willing, rather than just say, well, he's rooted and who cares, she's willing to stick with him. Now, the question I was going to ask is, well, actually, you know what? I don't have to ask.
I don't know what the question
is. Well, is it?
Does that make her a bad feminist?
Yes.
Of course not. She's showing compassion. She's showing compassion for someone that she kind of cared about once upon a time.
Not really, ever. Well, there's no feeling in the book that she's ever cared for him in any – other than from a sort of nostalgic maybe.
Well, yeah. So she's just showing compassion for someone who's going to be gone in a few days and who's not actually being much of a burden at the moment.
But the fact that he didn't rape her or anything like that. There's no talk of it. But he did abuse her. No, he abused her. He didn't smack her. He didn't rape her. He didn't cause pain to her. But he
it
mentally,
was an arranged marriage.
Yes. Okay. But
yes.
He mentally abused her in the sense that she was always expected to cook for him because it's made very clear in the novel that she's the greatest, one of the great cooks of our time, in a sense. And that's actually the food elements in this book. It made me hungry quite often. Yeah. So there's an abuse there. It's an underlying abuse. Isn't there? Am I missing something here? No, he's just a figure of fun.
The thing that, I mean, as the narrator points out, the thing that frustrated Palmer more than anything else was not just that she had to cook for him all the time because, I mean, the man is comically a glutton. He eats as much as 20 people. He's always hungry, I think. There's something in the book where Palmer's – she wonders at some stage if he actually – which is actually a real disorder. There is a genetic disorder where it's quite rare, but people will they don't actually have the capacity to feel full. They're always literally constantly hungry. They're always hungry. That the urge to eat is constant because they just never feel like they've
I've
eaten.
Heard of that, yeah.
Yeah. So whether this is this guy's deal or whether he really is just a glutton. But the thing which gets on Palmer more than anything else is he's just he's indiscriminately gluttonous. So she makes this great food and she's renowned as this wonderful cook who makes these beautiful subtle meals and he just doesn't care. He doesn't care if it's like a bowl of porridge or if it's, you know, this meal that
I think he does care a bit because he does go to hunt her down to find her because I think
because he likes the food, but like he doesn't really he's not an aficionado. Doesn't sit there and go, oh, the balance of the spices that you've used is exquisite and I can taste cumin coming underneath. And that's, I mean, the narrator says at one point that's what frustrated her more than anything else, is that she was just not a, like her skills were not appreciated, just her ability to provide.
But the narrator also questions whether she should stay behind.
Of course.
Which is what I love, that there's that self-awareness about it.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think, well, it's this sort of knowing self. I think knowing the way a reader might respond to that.
Like me.
Like a reader like you. But this is the thing.
She's not abused. We can't say, because he's a figure of fun anyway.
No, I don't think it's not abuse.
Okay.
It was an arranged marriage in a culture that has a lot of arranged marriages. It didn't work out. She left. She's refused to go back to him, even though he followed her and hilarity ensued. And she just shows
She maintains her empowerment throughout even that.
Of course she does. Okay. And, I mean, she chooses to stay. She shows an act of compassion to quite obligation. A pitiful human being who everyone else has deserted.
Okay. And, you've answered that.
And I don't think that's treading the line of, oh, well, of course she would do that because she's a woman and women are more compassionate. I don't think that's that at all. It's an act of human compassion for another human being. Okay. And I think anyone that would try to make the point of, oh, she's a bad feminist because she stayed with her husband and cooked for him, I think misses the point of that whole scene.
Okay, at the same time,
as the narrator,
the most highlighted in my Kindle version, the most highlighted quote
is
the following. There's some great lines in this book, which I'm not going to read out, but I've got a number of them highlighted. But this one, where eight people highlighted.
Oh, God.
And this I was interested in as well, why this one was the most. There is the secret. Show a woman that she has the power to improve you 1,000 times over, and she is yours for life.
Oh, from the man's point of view.
Yes.
Like if a woman shows a man she has the power to improve him,
I can fix you attitude.
Yeah, but it's actually reversed because the idea is that usually it's the woman who's going, oh, I can fix him.
No, show a woman that she has the power to improve
a man
1,000 times over and she's yours for life.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's from the narrator's point of view.
Yeah, it's from the narrator's point of view.
Highlighted eight times. Is it highlighted because of it's a problematic sentence or is it
I have no idea why it's highlighted.
I'm just wondering about
– I have no idea. The fact that the entire narrative sort of disproves it.
Actually, that's a good point.
Might suggest there's a bit of irony to that sentence.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
I mean, you can't pull out a sentence of a book and say, oh, and then here's what Karen Lord said. It's like actually the narrator said that, I think quite tongue-in-cheek with a nod to the way that people, but it's all reversed. I mean, the narrative reverses that. So
in what way?
In the way that Palmer, I mean, she doesn't improve. I mean, she, you know. Who's that it said in reference to?
It's actually in reference to the sister getting married to the poet.
Oh, right. So it's not even about Palmer.
No, it's going to do with Palmer.
Oh, right. Yeah. But, I mean, Palmer's story, I mean, she's not, like, she doesn't end up with.
Well, it's actually, no, what it is, I'll tell you what the scene exactly. Sorry, because I've actually mistaken that. It still doesn't have anything to do with Palmer. But Alton, who is the poet, has been paid to woo Semwe, I think the name,
sisters.
The sister. Yeah. And so he's now trying to think through poetry, but the problem he has is he's doing it for Lord Indigo, not for himself. So the next line in the context is, unfortunately, Alton was not being paid to woo in his own name, and everyone knew it. Semwe frowned a lot, but just, oh, and then bloody, bloody, blah. So, well, not that it's bloody, bloody, blah sort of writing, but yeah, so it's the context is very specific. I just found it interesting that eight people highlighted it out of context, that specific.
I have no idea why those eight people highlighted.
Yeah, I admit I'm getting a little.
But I mean,
bit
the narrative. She doesn't end up with Kwame because she thinks she can improve him, and therefore he's a man I can improve, and that's why I'll be with him. That's not why she ends up with Kwame the end.
She ends up with him because they're mentally and equals.
Yeah.
So I mean,
you know, it's and
I
she
loved
didn't,
how subtle that was. It wasn't. I love you.
Exactly.
It was just a sort of they came
and
together.
She didn't. She neither, you know, stayed with Nsingye nor left him. Because of that reason either. It's not like she stayed with him for so long thinking, oh, well, maybe he won't eat, maybe he won't eat, maybe he won't eat. You know, and she didn't leave him thinking, oh, I, you know.
Yeah.
It didn't work, I didn't fix him, therefore I'm going. I mean, the narrative of Palmer, which is what the story's about, undermines that. It's just a quip. I mean, for goodness sake, it's a narrator who's quite a cheeky narrator.
I do want to read out one bit towards the end.
Actually,
I think only I highlighted this one. Okay. Because I thought it was just beautifully written.
Okay.
Again, narrator, very self-aware, saying, I told you from the very beginning that it was a story about choices. Wise choices, foolish choices, small yet momentous choices. For with choices comes change, and with change comes opportunity, and both change and opportunity the very cutting edge of the power of chaos. And yet, as the undying ones know and as humans too often forget, even chaos cannot overcome the power of choice. See, I love that. That sort of elegiac.
Yes.
Fable-like. And that's how the book reads, and it's gorgeous like that.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful narrative voice. I really, really like the book.
Do you want to move on to Zoo City? Oh, no, four people highlighted.
Oh, four people. You're not alone.
No. But I did highlight that. Didn't
Can you stop saying bits that people highlight and how many there well, are?
No, the Zoo City, which we should move to. By the way, Karen Lord, that was Karen Lord's Redemption.
Yeah, Redemption and Indigo available from Small Beer Press. Quickly, in print and e-versions.
Yes, and also awards, because I won a few. It's won
It won the Crawford Award, which is a debut novel award for a fantasy novel. The Mythopoeic Award, which is awarded by the Mythopoeic Society, which... gives awards for both fiction and non-fiction dealing with mythology and folklore and topics like that. It was a World Fantasy Award finalist and was shortlisted and longlisted for several other awards. It's quite a good book and deservedly.
And I'm so happy that the Ghetto was willing to allow it in.
The Ghetto. What?
I got problems with the genre Ghetto and how we close our doors to books that are a little bit different, and I'm just happy that Karen Lord was allowed entry. I'm being a bit sarcastic.
I think you're very, very sarcastic.
But it is a gorgeous book, highly recommended. And we actually didn't spoil too much, surprisingly, in this conversation.
Yeah.
Because we ranted on about things that had nothing to do with it.
We did. And actually, I just want to pick up one little thread about the feminist thing. I think Palmer is an awesome female character. I think she's great. I think she's complex. I think she thinks about things a lot. Like she really considers things.
Yes,
you know,
she
takes her time. She's very smart. She's very compassionate. She has a happy ending, which is great.
Yes.
You know, she is a strong female character. Without, you know, needing to...
Without having to kick ass and shoot things. And
show her midriff.
Show her midriff, stake vampires. She does nothing of any... In fact, she's not built to do those sorts of action sort of things.
And, I mean, this is the thing.
It's all her intellect and her abilities.
I mean, she ends up negotiating with the Indigo Lord.
Yes.
I mean, that's how that is resolved, through conversation and argument and debate.
Yes.
And much thought.
Yes.
I think she's a fantastic feminist character. She really is. She's wonderful, and it's got nothing to do with her eschewing traditional female roles or attitudes or anything like that. You know, because she's also quite traditionally feminine. I mean, she's a cook. She's very family oriented. She ends up, you know, getting, that's her happy ending. She falls in love with a guy and gets married. I mean, none of these things need to be stripped away from a female character in order for her to be a strong female character. Yep. None of them have to be stripped away. They just have to be treated with respect and as valid choices, and choices that are made by the woman, not because she's pressured into things.
And nor is she a lust object just because just because she's empowered in that kick-ass sort of way.
Yeah.
And you've got
the nuns who are awesome. The sisters.
Oh, the nuns. Yeah, they're great.
They're fantastic.
We could actually speak quite – I mean, how long have we spoken about the book?
Quite a bit. Yeah. Well, we've spoken around the book a lot too, but we should probably move on. But, no, I would definitely recommend Palmer as being a really good example of a way to write a strong female character, to use the
– And I would recommend
the preferred lingo.
Karen Lord's Redemption and Indigo as a top-notch, fantastic book.
Yes.
Now
we should move on.
And because we've spoken already for 2 hours, we've only got 5 minutes for Zoo City.
That's silly. Well, this is a book I recommended you, and this was the first book I've recommended without having read it first. So it was your last one. It was my first one.
Yeah, very nice.
It should also be my last one. I felt bad recommending it without reading it, but I had read Moxieland, which was her first novel, which I loved.
Thankfully, it's a good book, isn't it?
And it is. I thought it would be. She'd have to be very off form for me not to at least like the book. And I really like it. I really like
now,
it a lot.
This is open for the Hugos this year, isn't it? It's eligible.
No, it's 2010.
No, I think you'll find it is.
Really?
I know it's 2010.
Because wasn't it on the Hugo ballot last year?
Was it?
Oh, hang on. First American printing, 2011. You're right.
Yes, it's eligible.
It may be Hugo nominee this year.
And I'd be pretty disappointed if it wasn't.
It did win the Arthur C. Clarke Award last year.
Yeah, the one, the Clark, that's right.
And it was nominated for a couple of the British Science Fiction Award.
Yeah, it's been
nominated.
It's been a lot of
And several other awards, but it did win the Arthur C. Clarke. But you're right, and it was also a World Fantasy
Okay.
Nominee.
And it is another, like the Karen Law book, it's another book.
So because it was published in America
in
2011, that makes it Hugo.
It's a bit like the Quantum.
Yeah,
I get.
And then the fact that Tim Powers Declare was nominated for
That's
Clark.
Separate, though.
I know. But
that's also to do with printing.
It's also to do with printing dates, yeah. Right? Because it was never published in the UK. Yes. So it got on the Arthur C. Clarke ballot last year when it's a very old book. So it is
eligible, and I would be, as I said, because we've read it already, so it'd be one less book to read on the for our Hugo podcast if we do one this year, which I think we will, and B, because it's a damn fine book. I don't think it's perfect by any stretch of the imagination. Sorry, Lauren, but
very few books are.
I think Redemption Indigo is close to perfect for me. Really, honestly, I loved it. I actually don't have a negative thing to say about it. This one, I have a few quibbles, but nothing. nothing major though. I would, as I said, I'd be really disappointed if it didn't find itself on the Hugos. I think it's going to struggle though, because I think of some of the big books that have come out last year. But anyway, we'll see.
Also, there is a—I mean, I had the perception that it was an older,
that probably will hurt.
So
it.
There is a perception.
I think that's what will hurt that in Quantum Thief. That unless people and there are people on the blogosphere who are saying this book is eligible.
Yeah,
you know, vote for it if you want like it. And I will nominate it, but because I can, because I'm bought supporting membership or whatever it's called. But I think you're right. That might be a problem that people will think it's not eligible. So
it is eligible, people. Nominate it. If you read it and like it, nominate
it. Yes. So for the people who listen to us, yes. If you're able to nominate, yes, do so. If you enjoyed it, don't do it just because we said so.
All these publication and I guess geographic restrictions for awards are getting a little bit silly these days, aren't they? I mean, I think
we all live in one big place.
Well, I'm just because it wasn't published in America till this year, I'm sure a lot of Americans had read it anyway.
But no, look, I don't want to get onto this.
No, let's not. That's a side issue. We've already talked too long about side issues. No. Never mind. Moving on.
Not everyone's
internet
savvy like you.
Moving on.
Zinzi December has a sloth on her back, a dirty 419 scam habit. Yes, she does. And a talent for finding lost things. But when a little old lady turns up dead and the cops confiscate her last paycheck, she's forced to take on her least favourite kind of job, missing persons. Which, to be frank, is the job every personal detective crime sort of novel is about. But, you know, that's besides.
It's a trope.
So, set in South Africa.
Yep.
Set in a future South Africa?
Set in an alternate South Africa.
Yeah, it's an alternate.
Because it goes into the past of stuff that hasn't happened in our past.
Yes, true.
So it's just an alternate South Africa. Set round about now.
Correct.
Except
yeah, right.
just in a parallel universe one or two steps over.
One where in the world, if you've got some sort of guilty conscience or you've done something criminal.
If you've killed someone.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. You have to have killed someone.
Yeah, you've read this more recently. I read this 2 weeks ago.
If you've killed someone, you get given an animal.
Yeah, you get an animal appears. I mean,
no one gives it. No one rocks up to your door and says, "Here's your sloth." No, an animal just appears.
Yes,
it's called being animaled.
And I'll say this now: the book never explains, and thankfully, how or why that occurs. It just does.
Yeah. No, and it doesn't explain a lot of things. It's really good. It's the kind of world building I love, which gives you enough information so that you can navigate the world and you know what's going on, but you don't necessarily know, you know, the last 1,000 years of history.
No, but do you know what the smartest thing she does? And it's a cheat. It's the biggest cheat in the world.
What is it?
But I love it. I'm glad she did it. Rather than have characters do expository stuff, she has the non-fiction article.
Oh, yeah. It's not a cheat.
It's
not a cheat. It's not. It's a structure.
Okay. I want to see someone do expository stuff without having to.
This is the way she's done it. This is the way to do that kind of exposition.
Okay, it's like, well, I'll structure the book non-linear. I mean, it's a style. I get that.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. There was a small part of me, maybe the wrong part of me, maybe a bad part of me that thought it was a bit of a cheat, but a good one. I'm glad she did it. I'm not angry with her. I didn't throw the book against the wall and say, "Oh, a non-fiction article. That's how she's going to explain X, Y, and Z."
I think maybe using the word cheat is a bit unfair. You could say it was an easier way to do it than trying to work it into the narrative.
Yes,
without info dumping.
Well, a lot of first-person books, the first person seems to pretend that the person that is reading it has never lived in the world.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems.
Which I find a bit lazy.
Correct.
And infuriating to read. I hate first-person narratives like that.
Yeah.
Which is why I love this one. This one was
predominate.
Great.
Kirsten.
I know.
You read any urban fantasy book, which this sort of is in that. Again,
this is absolutely sort of, urban fantasy.
Yeah. So read any urban fantasy book that isn't written by Lauren Burkus, I think it is.
I think we're saying Burkus.
Burkus.
There's a slight South African accent on it, which I can't reproduce. So I'm just saying Burkus.
My parents in law are South African. Should I give them a call and see if they can?
I don't think we need to phone a friend on this one.
Okay, great. So anyway, yes. I don't know. So you've interrupted me. So, yeah. So every other book that isn't written by her does do that. Feels the need to info dump.
Every other book.
I read a lot of Jim Butcher.
No, it does.
Jim Butcher does it every book.
And
even if you already know the world, he'll info dump.
And it's perfectly accepted. Again, it is one of these things that gets drummed into people in MFAs and creative writing workshops that you show, don't tell. Sometimes you got to tell. Sometimes you really just have to tell. And it just depends how...
It's how you do it, though.
It's how good a writer you are.
Jack, I know we've been working each other for the last 15 years, but I need to tell you all this stuff that you already know, have known for the last 15 years, but I'm...
Do you know what would be really awesome? A really awesome way to do it is if you had a psychic character who was an amnesiac and just kept forgetting everything. So your main character just kept on having to say, oh, yeah, so you know that hamburger we had yesterday at lunch? No? Oh, so you've forgotten. Never mind, we had a hamburger yesterday at lunch, and at that time I told you this. That'd be awesome. The whole book would be this self-referential spiral back into what the... Anyway, I'm not going to write that book. Had if anyone not, wants ha- to write that book,
how did you know I was thinking that? I was, genuinely.
Yeah, so, I mean, it just depends. Every single book has to have exposition. It has to have it. You have to tell the reader what's going on in some way. And I think the way she's done it, because the way she has done it by putting in excerpts of documents fits in with the world. And the documents tell their own little story too. It's really good that, like, each insert is its own little story. So it's great.
Yeah.
It was really clever. And the voices are varied, which is really good.
Although I got the impression from the acknowledgements that she didn't actually write the non-fiction-y bits, or at least a couple of them. She wrote the scam letters.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Because she thanks a couple of people. And Lauren, if you're listening, please feel free to Twitter that we're wrong or right. But that she either got a heap of research.
Yeah. Oh, she definitely did a lot of research.
Somewhere. Oh, look, I didn't.
Anyway.
It's irrelevant anyway.
But yeah, no, I think that's it is an easier way to do it, but I think it's a perfectly valid way. And when it's done in an entertaining way, like she has, it's really cool.
Yes, I
like
loved
the little bits.
Reading the first scam letter.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. If those scam letters, they're like the Nigerian scam letters that we've all gotten the emails, exactly the same, but except they're written in perfect English. They're not grammatically incorrect. They don't feel fake. They actually feel genuine.
Yeah, the character, like Zinzi, who is she writes the scam letters for the scammers, and is occasionally involved in performing the scam as well. But mainly, she writes the scams, and she's doing it because she's had a nasty drug habit, and she was in debt, and the scammers basically, you know, the crime lord guy who's running this kind of took over her debt, and so she owes him, and so she's writing this to kind of pay off her debt and blah, blah, blah. It's that kind of situation. So that's why she's doing it. She doesn't feel particularly good about it, but, you know, she's telling herself the usual thing about, well, if people weren't greedy, they wouldn't fall for it, and if they didn't have the money in the first place, they wouldn't have it to spend, and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So she's writing these letters, but she specializes in – and how does she describe it? Is it current affairs chic or something like that she labels it?
Yeah.
She specializes in by picking an item that's a really hot topic on the news and writing to that theme. So instead of just saying, oh, yes, my great uncle was a military general in a corrupt dictatorship that's now folded and he's got $15 million to somehow get out of the country, she'll write it from a child who's in an orphanage that's been devastated and is being abused. And so it kind of hits these.
Let's just say, Lauren, I fell for that letter. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hook, line, and sinker. Oh, well, I really did. Because I didn't read the blurb, so I didn't know that.
Because
you're not told straight up.
No.
That Zinzi's
so that's
into
what
this.
She does.
It's just it's one of those inserts in the book that this is this letter. And you go, wow, that's really sad. Oh, my God, that's so sad.
Terrible.
Oh, there's a phone number or email address.
Oh, how do I give money?
I know it's a fictional book, but maybe it'll work. Set in an alternate universe where you have animals appear magically and stuff, but... Oh, I've lost
so, me. So that's what she does. And the other thing that she does, because when you have when you get animaled, you also get some kind of a gift.
Yes,
which
power.
Isn't, again, you know, the origins of it, the way it works, the mechanics isn't made clear, and it doesn't need to be made clear.
No, absolutely.
Because you know how it works, or you know what is working. You don't need
although,
to know why.
Although
exactly
you could
how.
Argue, because it's basically a crime thriller sort of story.
Yeah.
You could say, well, all that stuff with the animals and the magical bits, they're just window dressing. Really, if you got rid of all that stuff, you could still have a similar story.
Sure, but.
No, it's well, again, you gave me the look. I'm saying that how much do those elements inform the world? I get that.
I think they inform the world. They inform the characters, and I mean, they actually play. There is plot elements that are deliberately dependent on the fact that Zinzi and others have certain gifts, and the animals. I mean, the whole thing actually revolves around the animals. The whole story is around the animals and what people do with them.
The whole reason for the crime,
yeah.
Et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
I understand that.
So it's integral to the world that's built up.
No.
But I mean, you can say that with about just about any fantastic
I was
thing.
Leading to the point.
Yes. Okay.
That's what I liked about the book, and that it is integral. It isn't window dressing.
No, it's absolutely not window dressing. It's not just a crime story and, oh, let's throw in some animals. the story is about the zoos. They're called zoos, people with an animal. And that's why it's Zoo City, because this is this little broken-down enclave.
Yeah.
Which is based on a real suburb in Johannesburg.
Yes.
That used to be quite well-to-do and has since fallen into disrepair. Like, it went through the kind of levels of well-to-do and then just kind of, I guess, you know, a bit bohemian and now is sort of ghettoized, and there's a lot of immigrants and refugees and you know, people with social issues and homelessness and all
and
that
without
sort of
using
stuff.
Your term that's used a lot, it does have that dystopic feel about dystopic. I don't think it's actually a term. Dystopia feel about
no, dystopic is a is term.
It?
Yeah.
Sounds like a toilet flushing thing.
But I think, I mean, apart from the animals and, you know, that fantastical element, it's a very real portrayal of this kind of, I guess, underlife of a major city, where you will have ghetto areas, you will have areas where people of very low, if almost no socioeconomic means, congregate and things, and the places that aren't cared for necessarily by the wider society. So it was a very good portrait of that. And I really like Zinzi as a character. I didn't like her as a person a lot of the time, but as a character, I thought she was
that's
amazing.
The strength of the book, because I think the crime plot isn't actually that strong, but I think the character of Zinzi is fantastic.
Yeah.
Because she isn't necessarily a nice person.
She's not an awful
I'm not,
person.
Well,
she's just not inherently likable. She's not like this plucky kid who.
No.
You know,
but she's
old. I mean, she's older for a start. Well, she's in her 30s, which is really good.
You know, let me justify my offhand remarks. So people just think I'm a person who makes offhand remarks, which is true. But sometimes I do
okay,
try.
Okay, continue.
No, what I was trying to say is that yes, because she is involved in these scams. Yes, forced into it, but we all have choices, and she is forced to be involved in directly in the scam, and there's that bit where the couple come
in the hotel,
which is really, and she has to pretend
and
to be
and sloths in her bag.
Yeah, and she has to pretend
really
to be
so
the subject of the scam, and it's, you know, heartbreaking. And yet her conscience on these things, in spite of the fact that she's got sloth, she doesn't think about it all the time. She has that slight prickle in the back of her head. But I think Laura makes it clear that it's not something that's causing her to want to commit suicide
or
blow her brains out or whatever. So, and there's that, and then there's the fact that she's not. She wants as much as possible. She wants an easy life. She doesn't necessarily. I mean, she doesn't like looking for missing people. She doesn't like getting mixed up in all that stuff.
Yeah, because she generally doesn't. She just looks for, because her gift is that she can kind of trace the tendrils of things that people have lost. So she describes it as like being this sort of ethereal, sort of smoky thing that she can kind of see, which connects something, like, you know, if you lose your keys, you lose a ring, you lose your hat on the bus, she can kind of follow the tendril of that from you, your physical body to wherever that thing is, and so she makes money by doing the 419 scams, and she makes money by, you know, taking a small commission to find things people have lost, but she doesn't like doing it with missing people.
Well, what I was going to say is, and this is very shallow, a very shallow perspective, but from that's from me, that is not Zinzi. She gets quite upset when her lover, Benoit, that's how I'm pronouncing it, finds his family because his family's lost a refugee camp sort of thing. And his wife, he has evidence that they've appeared and he wants to go.
Because he thought they were dead. He thought his wife and children were dead. He's a refugee and he thought they were killed.
Zinzi can't cope because she loves Benoit and feels betrayed to a degree. And you can't
help but
feel.
It's one of those horrible situations.
Yeah, I know it is. I know it is. And shallow me thought, you know, be happy for him, get over it. But I know it's tough.
Yeah.
But that's where the strength of the character
is.
It's a genuine reaction in the hands of someone else. It might have been, wasn't that great? But it's done so genuinely, and the character feels genuine as if just walking down the street.
And she feels bad that she doesn't feel happy for him.
Authentic.
You know, she feels bad that she can't feel happy for him, right? You know, she kind of berates herself a little.
Yeah.
But the fact is that she does love him, and the fact is that he wasn't – I mean, it reminded me, I mean, only tangentially of the TV show Homeland, because it's a similar –
which I haven't seen.
Well, it's just a similar setup where, you know, there was a guy who was presumed dead, a soldier in Iraq, presumed captured and killed like 8 years ago. And his wife has kind of gotten on with her life a little and has a new relationship. And then he comes back and he was never dead. And so there's this, like, it's one of these just horrible situations where no one's at fault. I mean, not, you know, like, but the guy, suddenly his wife and child have, like, they may be alive, like her boyfriend finds out they may be alive.
But even when she speaks to Benoit, she's genuinely really not happy for him. It's one thing to think it. When she's with him, she feels betrayed by him and says as much.
Yeah.
You know, which you sort of think, oh, that's – but Lauren does it so well.
She's not going to pretend that she's happy
about
it. No,
that's the point. Lauren does it. Rather than me think you're a bitch and I don't know why I'm reading about you, I felt, no, that's – these are all genuine reactions from a genuine character who's been through shit, who's lost her brother because of something she – that's why she has a sloth. Never explained exactly why her brother is dead and how she was involved and – but it's something
– but obviously it's her fault because she's got a sloth.
Yeah. She was
– because you don't – because there's a – there is a mention in the book that if you have someone killed, for instance, you would get an animal. So you can't keep your hands clean by, like, paying someone else to kill someone.
Yeah.
They might get an animal too. I'm not sure how it works. But, I mean, you would get one because you have caused them to be killed.
Yeah.
And it's not murder. It's killing. So you could accidentally kill someone, like a hit and run.
Yeah.
And you would get an animal. So it's not even tied to intention. It's just that if you kill someone, you get an animal.
Yeah.
Or if you directly cause someone to be. So somehow she has caused her brother's death, whether it was an accident on her part.
Yeah, she's got a lot of baggage coming into this book. But again, and where this is really strong is that, yes, it weighs her down, but it's not on her mind every page of the – there are books where they get so angsty that everything gets – pushed to the side because the character is in such a dark place. Zinzi's actually reasonably –
she's functioning.
More than functioning.
She's high functioning.
Yeah.
She's not functioning as she would like. She doesn't particularly like what she has to do to live and make money and stay in her ratty little
apartment.
But
she sleeps at night. That's the impression I get.
Yeah, because you kind of have to. I mean, this is what made her such a real character, because if you're in a situation like that, you can't be thinking about it all the time. You would go insane. You just put it out of your mind. I know, but then it's not her book, is it? Then it's someone who's just sitting in a room in the corner rocking back and forth. I mean, for her to be a functioning person like she is.
I'm trying to imagine the same book with this person.
With someone who can't cope.
Someone's come up to me and said, can you find this missing person? They're just going,
This is the thing. Like, yes, there are some people who wouldn't be able to cope.
Yeah.
But then they couldn't have this story. So if you are someone who is coping after what you've been through, it's not something that you think about every day.
But it's very hard for the writer to make that person still seem realistic and not just somehow a superhuman, because they can compartmentalize their mind to such a degree that their past and things that they're doing right now don't affect how they act. But again, Laura makes it very clear that, yes, they do affect Zinzi.
Yeah.
Zinzi does get hurt. But when the time comes, she can put those things aside and act as she has to.
Yeah.
And all authentic, all realistic. None of it feels like she's like a superwoman, for example.
No, I think she's great. I love sloth. I kind of wanted a sloth.
Yeah.
Or a mongoose. A mongoose is cool.
Yeah.
But this is the thing, you don't decide what animal to get, and you don't like the animals you do get, they don't seem to reflect anything. Like it seems to be quite arbitrary.
Yeah, correct.
And I mean, even Zinzi and the people in the book say, no one knows what animal you're going to get. Nothing seems to reflect anything.
Yeah.
So you could, I mean, one woman has, she sounds pretty lucky actually. She's got a tiny little black scorpion and she can just put it in a purse.
Yeah, that's right.
So she goes around to a lot of the shelters and she acts as an advocate on behalf of people because she can hide a scorpion. So because the zoos are quite discriminated against in this society. So she is a zoo. She's only a very tiny character. She's in there for, I think, like a paragraph she's mentioned. But, I mean, this is how good the world building in this book is that Lauren Burkus can just have this kind of side comment about something and it just fleshes out the world in this beautiful way. So you'll have this woman where there's literally, I think, a small paragraph about her and it's mentioned that she's got this scorpion. That's her animal because she has obviously killed someone. So she's got a scorpion, but it's a little scorpion she can put in her bag and this is what she does because she acts as an advocate on behalf of zoos and she can go in and she can fill out government grant applications and all this stuff and no one knows she's a zoo.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it just builds this world up.
But on that note,
the
potential apartheid metaphor that this book could have been all about or discriminatory or black versus white sort of metaphor, which you could say that District 9 was – is it District 9?
District 9.
Yeah, was very clearly that.
Yeah.
This could have been the same, but it's just part of the world. The discrimination's there. It's clearly stated, but it's not –
I think this is more about social issues. It's not, I mean, it's okay. It's set in South Africa. So, and you know, it is a post-apartheid book. It kind of just has to be by its very nature,
yes.
But it's not about, and I don't think,
but discrimination's there. So the fact that it's set in a place that once did that and now has a new set of, people who have these animals. So in a sense, it's like, well, we've done it before. We can do it again. We can discriminate quite easily.
Yeah, but the whole world does. I mean, this is the thing, it's actually like this phenomenon with the animals has happened on a global basis. And is it in China where she says they shoot you?
Yeah.
Because it's like evidence of your guilt. If you've got an animal, you're guilty. So bye-bye.
Yeah, and of course the great image about the Osama bin Laden analogue in this book who appears one day with a penguin in a flak jacket.
Yeah.
That's
and other countries, I think France and the US, I think Australia, they're forcibly studied. So there's a lot more infringement of rights. I mean, it's quite interesting the tidbit she drops about how zoos are treated in other parts of the world, sometimes better, sometimes worse. So that this situation in South Africa is it doesn't – like it's not the worst thing that could happen. It's not the best thing that could happen. It's just a really bad situation.
And it does inform the crime element in the sense that you understand why the person who's done what they've done – we can spoil it, can't we?
I guess so.
Because we've been doing that for the last 15 podcasts. So basically one of the characters who we meet – look, I'm not going to go into the plot details because it's boring, but basically he's trying to get rid of his zoo.
Yeah.
And you can actually pass your zoo on to someone else, but there's a lot of blood involved and death and that usual stuff. So, yes, again, it's someone saying, well, I can't live like this. I can't live with my zoo. It's too much
discrimination. And if I'm in a privileged enough position, I can get rid of it.
Correct.
I mean, I think the real analogue here is not apartheid so much as the refugee and immigrant issue.
Yes, yes.
Because
absolutely.
That's the global issue and the ongoing global refugee crisis, essentially.
Yeah.
That almost every country has to deal with it from one end or the other.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the setting, I think, of the book, and that's really how these zoos are treated. And so different countries have different policies on how to deal with them, but they're here and they keep coming because, of course, people keep killing people. So it's all and you've got detention centres and prisons and it's quite a remarkable achievement in world building for such often sketchy details. She says a lot with a very little,
which is
very admirable. I think it's great storytelling.
And it fits the style, the sort of crime noir, Chandler-esque. I don't know across what terms we now use to describe that sort of writing, but where
I think she calls it noir.
Noir, yeah. Well, so. I mean, you've got great things like a description of one character where it's said she has a round face with cheeks like apples. I love that. Some of them are a bit tortured, though. Like,
you highlighted.
I did, because some of them are a little bit tortured. Like, Emmanuel's grin drops from his face like a kicked puppy, bounces on the pavement, and tumbles into the gutter with a little pitiful yelp.
Yeah, some are a bit extended.
That's a little bit tortured for my taste, as in terms. But I love the one. She has a round face with cheeks like apples. Is perfect.
Is it?
And another one I liked is, all it takes is one Afghan warlord to show up with a penguin in a bulletproof vest, and everything science and religion thought they knew goes right out the window. I just went and highlighted all sorts of stuff in this book because it's a very highlightable book. But yeah. I didn't read it on my Kindle, so I don't know.
She has a very pithy writing style.
Yes, very much so. So, you know what the best bit of the book was? The thing that got me weeing in my pants just a bit. I got myself.
You need to wear diapers, don't you, when you read.
Yeah, I must have a slight problem there. Reference to Golden Compass.
Yeah, well, she kind of had to do it, didn't she? It's like it's really good that she
and the reference is a book written about the zoo phenomenon.
Yeah,
and it's steering by the Golden Compass, Pullman's fantasy in the context of the ontological shift.
Yeah, so even in this alternate world, Philip Pullman has written. The Golden Compass thing. I thought that was a very elegant little nod to it, to what must have been.
But it's this. It's like fantasy in the context of the ontological shift. Ontological shift. It's genius. Look, the quibbles I have with the crime story element, because it's a bit predictable, and if you've read enough crime novels.
Oh, I see. I didn't know, like, with the whole removing of the zoo. Like, I didn't.
Oh, that element. No, no.
I didn't get what was at the center of that.
Yeah,
mystery.
But that's unfair. Well, it's not unfair. You're not told.
I didn't even get that he had a zoo.
No,
that was all.
Yeah,
quite,
no, you're right. That's well done. Yeah. But the
that was quite a shock. But a particular scene where that happens, you just go, "Holy shit!"
I don't know why we're suddenly getting
because,
so.
Because you know, this spoilers. One's like, well. It's not that old a book. It's only just been published in the States last year.
Yeah, right.
And I don't think we need to reveal that particular ending.
No, it's a what the fuck moment.
Yeah, you're just going to go, oh, shit.
But the
and
thing,
so well set up in the book.
Yeah, this would make a great film.
It's been the film rights have been purchased by a South African director. So
because that scene would be awesome.
I know.
But, yeah, that's great. The motivation why the character's doing what he's doing is great.
Yep.
But who the bad guy is – Now, she might say, well, it's meant to be, but I don't know. I think it's not meant to be that clear that.
Oh, I think it's pretty. I kind of suspected.
Well, then Zinzi runs around doing stuff for no particular good reason. Because Zinzi doesn't know who it is.
No, Zinzi doesn't know. But Zinzi doesn't know. Zinzi doesn't know she's in a crime novel.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what you always have to. You know, Zinzi doesn't know. We are reading a novel. We are familiar with tropes. We are familiar with the rhythms of particular stories.
Yeah, but it's not an episode of Columbo.
She doesn't know.
It's not an episode of Columbo where it's made obvious who the bad guy is at the start and now Columbo's got to figure it out, but it's the genius of Columbo that makes it interesting.
Yeah.
This is not Columbo. This is Zinzi, doesn't know what's going on, having to figure it out. And I think Lauren tries to chuck the odd red herring in to divert our attention from who the actual bad guy is, but I don't think does it well enough, for my taste, from a crime perspective.
Okay,
it's the
enough.
Only quibble that I've got with the book.
Fair enough. I don't read a lot of crime, so... That probably didn't bounce back as much to me.
Okay. And my other little quibble is the Ghost in the Machine stuff, which just came out of left field.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that related in with the world it's, although maybe it's a lot, you know, it might be to do with Zinzi's lost thing that's something she could just see. But
What it is is basically Zinzi gets a bunch of emails that are gibberish.
Well, they're like that spam poetry. I used to collect that. That doesn't come anymore. Now it's just people wanting to give me money.
She gets them at particular times. She figures out she's getting them when a murder takes place.
Yeah.
And, in fact, via the email she can sort of triangulate where the murders are.
And because emails kind of refer to, in a poetical way, kind of reference the person and the way they were killed.
And what she says is, well, it's actually – is it the ghost of the person dying?
Yeah, that's what she thinks it might be.
Yeah, passing on – literally the ghost.
Passing on a message.
A message via a computer, which I thought was interesting but felt like it came from a different novel.
Yeah.
As a concept.
Yeah.
It didn't feel suited to this book.
No, it did – yeah. No, I'd agree with that. It didn't bug me so much.
We sound like food reviewers when we say you know, it's like that
sauce.
A bit
heavy on the cardamom, but they'd added some mustard seeds.
that hollandaise wasn't required.
Hollandaise is never required.
Béarnaise sauce, then. I love hollandaise. So that goes to the machine, and it's annoying because it also does push on the plot as well. It's actually quite important.
Yeah.
So it just felt, I don't know why that's there. But, I do know why it's there for the plot, but I don't know why it's there for the world building. So that's the only
She could have had another plot way around that.
Yeah.
I just wasn't sure why. Yeah. It didn't bug me overly because I was kind of just going along with the book at that stage, and it was just another little kind of, because it kind of fit in because it fit in with the scam things, and it felt like it fit in the book. If you think about it too much, you're going, yeah, well, actually, maybe not. But, I had a lot of fun reading this book. This is a really fun book to read.
It is amazingly fun.
And it was really pacey, and the character of Zinzi was awesome. And I loved, the twins and that house that she goes to, and the missing twin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when she goes to the house to talk to the other twin who's not missing, and he's just there with his two friends, and it's just like these 15-year-olds playing video games and eating food and I really liked that whole celebrity.
Why do they kill the old woman at the start?
So they can blackmail her, like to set her up.
Oh, that's right. Because
their
patsy.
Superannuation scheme, to speak. So that's specifically done to set her up.
I'm Mr. Expert on crime books, but I...
You miss that.
Yeah. So everything I've said has no credit.
You can miss things.
Like City
Everyone
in the City.
Missed things. I didn't say it. I love the world. I love that you're only given enough of the world to be able to navigate around. I love the voice of the book. I was told in present tense, which is one of my favourite tenses. And there was just a little quibble I had with a device that she used a couple of times.
Yes, can we talk about that? Before we do, can I just say another line?
Oh, okay, sure.
Great Gatsby, by the way, of Lady Gaga in Shades of White and Silver. That's a corker. See, that's great. There's a couple out there.
Did you ever used to underline books, physical?
No. But
so this is a brand new world for you of being able to annotate.
Yes, and I can just chuck in my thoughts. For example, I thought the running around in the sewers of Johannesburg or whatever felt a bit like padding to me in terms of the story. There's an action bit where
there's a bunch of kids.
Kids who are – and again, it relates back to – the main motivation of the novel, because I think they've got animals that are disconnected from their.
No, they've got animals that they've chopped bits off of,
yes,
to sell
right.
For animal to sell, parts.
Yes, but it is connected though to the, because they're going to do that to the crocodile.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that world building.
Yeah, it is world building, but it just felt like a protracted bit of.
Yeah, you didn't have to have the chase through the sewer, but I guess it's just. I mean, sometimes you do things with books and movies where. You're just ramping up the discomfort factor for your character so that and they can be incidental. I mean,
these are minor quibbles.
A lot of like with Blade Runner, a lot of the movie that is, the rain aspect of Blade Runner, it's world building, but it's also the fact that your character is just constantly uncomfortable. And you often do things with a book where you are loading up your character with all this bad stuff.
The rain in Blade Runner is unobtrusive. It's just there.
But it's a thing like Harrison Ford's
15
dripping
pages
wet
of running through sewers, as it's written, felt to me like.
I'm not comparing it to Blade Runner, like exactly. I'm just saying sometimes you do things just to make characters more uncomfortable. And which kind of did that because that ends up with her losing her phone.
And it has importance. It's not like it's a scene that just comes out of nowhere. But, okay, as a writer, would you have done that?
I don't know.
Okay, well, that's an answer to that question.
I didn't write Sioux City, so I don't know. I probably not, but then I'm not given to big action thingies, so.
Yeah, okay, fine. Anyway, there was just, again, it's a minor quibble. But, so what were you saying?
I can't remember. Oh, the present tense thing.
Yes.
Yeah. She did it two or three times and I
love how you picked up the physical version of the book, which you haven't actually read, to look for these quotes.
And then I'm like, oh no, I've got to go back to my e-version where I bookmarked it.
I mean, the spine's not even cracked.
No,
literally.
I've not read it.
Literally.
I've not read it.
It is actually, Angry Robot do produce some really nice looking books.
I tell you what, to our listeners, because I've got a few of these books now that I don't need anymore. So people who recommend a book to us, an ebook, an original ebook for our future ebook special, if you recommend a book to us and we read it and we actually do like it, maybe I'll send you a copy of some of the books that we've done over the the podcast.
Maybe.
As a bit of an incentive.
Maybe. Well, look, you just said maybe. I will send you. I'll think about it. Yeah, that was a great book. You recommended it. Ah, bugger. I'm going
to
keep the book.
Well, I'm not saying maybe I will send. I'm saying maybe we can do that as a thing, but I'd have to go check what books we have and announce it next month.
All right,
maybe.
We have Zoo City.
We have Zoo City, and I'll see what other ones we have to give away to people. And I say just we, might just I mean be a random book thing. And but only if we like the book you recommend. If you recommend it's rubbish and we hate it, no books for you.
No books.
anyway, though, but back to the present tense thing, because I do like present tense, as listeners may know. And for the most part, it doesn't skip a beat and it's really good. But she has this one little, it's almost like a tick, and it's a leftover, I think, it's a leftover third person, not even third person, but definitely a leftover past tense thing where you can do it when there's, it's basically, it's a future tense. So the example, and it's done two or three times, but the example I've bookmarked here is, she comes back to her flat and her boyfriend is like cooking dinner and he never cooks dinner. And he's also like, they had a really big night the night before and blah, blah, blah. And so so Zinzi says to him, "You're looking very chipper for someone who should still be suffering the mother of all hangovers. And what's this?" And then outside of dialogue, "It will turn out that I have good cause to be suspicious." But that's future tense.
I still don't get what the problem is.
Because this is written in present tense, and it's written as an ongoing narrative.
So if she'd written it in past tense.
So how does she know at that moment that she's going to have reason to be suspicious?
If she'd written it in past tense.
It would all be past tense, and you could
do that.
Yeah, because it would kind of fit in with the flow of the tense, because the whole thing is written as something that happened before, maybe 5 seconds ago, maybe 5 years ago. I mean, it has that part. But what she's done is she's placed a future tense into a present tense. And they're unnecessary too. And it's not often. It's like a little tick. And she's done it two or three times. But each time I just went, oh. And it's, I guess, laden a bit of foreboding. So, I'd have reason to be suspicious. And the reader thinks, oh, why? But really, I mean, she could have just said, you know, that Zinzi was suspicious. And that would be enough of a foreshadowing for what's about to happen.
It's really first person, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Zinzi can say, you know, it's suspicious that he's doing this. And she kind of gets that anyway in the rest of the narrative.
Yeah,
these two or three little future tense moments, they were all unnecessary and they just kind of, yeah, I mean, that's a cheat. When you talk about cheating in literary terms, that's a cheat on the tense that you've chosen because you it's this ongoing narrative.
Lauren, I didn't notice.
I know, I'm pedantic.
You're pedantic, whereas I think the non-fiction things are cheat. No, I'm just kidding.
But I really, really love present tense, and it's a tense that's beat up on a lot by people. And it's beat up on because it's often done very badly.
I thought second person was beaten up, not present.
Oh, second person. Oh, yeah.
Everyone uses present tense.
No, they don't. A lot of people. No.
Really?
No. I've seen it beaten up by people who think it's a literary snobby thing to do. I've seen it beaten up from the other point of view of that it's just a cheating way to get pacing going.
But isn't it the best way of getting active over passive voice? I don't know why we're discussing this.
It's a good way to do it. But I mean, the thing is, when you make a choice about at base level, when you're deciding to write something, you're making a lot of choices before you even put a word on a page, and you're deciding, very basic choices of, you know, third person or first person, or if you're very brave, second person.
Charles Stross.
Yeah, I haven't read that. I'm interested in reading it.
It's two novels.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a second person device that's actually first person, but it's when you're writing to someone, so you use you all the time, but really that's a first person. But anyway, so you generally choose between first and third person, occasionally second person, and then you choose your tense, you choose your tone, you choose all this sort of stuff, and each of these choices that you make will have some advantages and some disadvantages, and the thing is, whatever choice you make, you've got to do the best you can with its advantages because that's why you've chosen it, but you've got to work with the disadvantages as well. And you can't just say, oh, well, I won't worry about that now because I need to do this thing that the tense or the point of view or whatever it is won't let me do, but I want to do it anyway.
I really do that. I'm not being snide. I really love it when you get pedantic on these things. And it's not pedantic. You're picking up a genuine issue. Although in the case of Zoo City, it happens, what, 3 or 4 times?
Two or three times. It's really not a big thing. But it just grated on me just a little bit because it was like, wow, and you didn't even have to do it. Like they were unnecessary. It wasn't even a case of you really needed to put some information in that you couldn't do in the format you've chosen, so you just broke form. Like they didn't have – it was just this clever little – it's like Stephen King does it all the time.
Yeah, but he's
writes from a narrative point of view of an omniscient narrator most of the time.
But he does too, yes.
In past tense.
Well, like so Karen Lord can do it.
The voice. Karen Lord can absolutely
and,
do it.
And in fact
it.
Did it a lot.
And it works because that's the voice that you've chosen. That's the narrator you've chosen. That's the point of view and the tense. And all of that works to construct the authenticity we spoke about.
Actually, is the Karen Lord eligible for the Hugo? So it probably isn't because that was
published. Oh, no, that's not eligible.
No. Okay, sorry.
All of that works to make the authenticity that we've talked about, to make the reading seamless. And, a lot of people won't pick that up.
I'm not going to talk about race and feminism in regard to this book because we'll go on for another 2 hours. And
I don't think there's nothing to talk about in terms of anything that's problematic or controversial.
No, there isn't.
I found that there's a I guess we can say, Lauren Burkus is a white South African writer, and her point of view protagonist is a black South African woman.
And I do wonder how much baggage that has from the South African.
Well, I actually listened to her talk on YouTube today. And she related it a little, and I'd actually read this before, and when I heard her say it, I went, oh, that's right, I'd heard that. She had a black South African friend who she'd sent the manuscript to read for what she wanted to be read for inconsistencies in the character's voice and attitude and all that stuff, which might be breaking character because it's stuff that Lauren writing as a white woman is just not getting, like little subtle things. So she sent the manuscript to a friend who came back with her with all these little tweaks and notes about Joburg and about dialects and things like that, but nothing really about Zinzi. And Lauren said, but this is great, and yeah, I'll fix all that, but I want to know about Zinzi. Like, is she black enough? And her friend kind of laughed and said, well, what's black enough? I mean, she's Zinzi. She's a great character. She works. She doesn't come across as shallow or one-dimensional.
It's the minefield. This is such a bloody minefield.
But the point is that that's what Lauren Burkus did. Like, she did the – and this is what I mean. Like, Lauren Burkus has written this character in this setting with respect, and she's acknowledged that she's not going to be an authority on this particular culture. Although she did grow up in Johannesburg.
Yeah, but that's only in the sense that she knows where the place.
Oh, yeah,
knows the street.
Like I'm saying, she's not someone who's grown up in a completely different place and has just gone there for 2 weeks for research. Yeah. But and so she's acknowledged that she may have these cultural blind spots, and so she's.
But wait, where has she acknowledged that in the book itself? Not.
No, as the writer, she's acknowledged as you do with any place in your work where you may have blind spots. And so she's run it by someone who may not have those particular blind spots to see if there's something that she's missed, which is and not everyone does that. Not everyone has to do it.
Yeah, I can't think of an example right now, but I have heard that thing where someone has said, well, I sent it to a gay person, Jewish person.
No, but she's
bloody,
not.
Bloody, bloody, blah. And this is a book that's been vilified, by the by, and they said it was fine, or they made a few suggestions. So basically you're saying that person doesn't understand their own – and that's why I'm saying it's a minefield.
It is a minefield. But what I'm saying is that Lauren Burkus has just written the book from, I think, from a point of respect and not wanting to appropriate a culture, not wanting to pillage it, not wanting to say, oh, this is really cool, I'm just going to make this great book about stuff and I'll just take all the cool, funky bits. And it's not what she's done. And I think if she did make mistakes in the book and they were pointed out, she'd probably be quite happy to own up to them.
Yeah.
Just from what I've heard from her speaking and interviews with her. And that's all you can do, really.
In a different way, Zinzi's a great character, like Palmer is, in terms of
Zinzi,
empowerment.
Awesome.
Well, and Zinzi as well, again, in complete...
And I love that, and I can't say this enough, I love that she's in her 30s. I'd love it even more if she'd been in her 40s.
Yeah, but
I love that she's in her 30s. She's not this young 20-something.
No, she doesn't have the bare midriff as well. And also, there's no big sword that she, you know, smacks or stuff. She, like Palmer in a sense, doesn't do the big action. There are action moments in the story, which we've talked about.
There's a lot of physicality.
But even when she's running through the sewers, as much as that bit annoyed me just a little bit, there's no sense that she's superhuman and she's fucked. And
she gets herself beaten up quite a bit.
And only by luck and other things that she survived. Yeah. I mean, at the end, she should have died. It's by pure will, determination and luck. There's no sense of, well, she's got the special powers.
No, exactly.
And her magic power is no fucking use to her in dangerous moments.
Exactly. Because, I think she's great. And
if anything, it gets her into trouble because people who have also had magic powers.
People have manipulated her because of her powers.
Correct. So, again, I love that.
Yeah.
Urban fantasy doesn't do that enough.
No, this is a really great urban fantasy.
This is how they should all be written.
In fact, this is exactly what urban fantasy should be.
So there's no friction between her and a person who she shouldn't love but will fall in love with.
Blah, blah, blah. Like in fact, that is kind of tipped on its head because she's in a relationship when the book starts.
Correct.
And when that relationship has a crisis, she reacts in a way that's very true to her. But doesn't come with all like the way you might expect in a lesser narrative. You know, there's no, because she could quite easily have done the whole, oh, that's okay, you go, I understand, you go back to your wife, I'll go cry in my room. And she doesn't, because that's not what she does.
Or worse, that could have been the relationship they have in the book could have been the backstory.
Yeah.
And he's now appeared again on the scene as a sort of subplot, and she's got this sexual tension because he's back with his wife and his family.
Yeah.
And she wants
to
be with him, and it turns out he's somehow involved in the plot as well. And he's a vampire for no particularly good reason.
And actually, just to stake him, but she doesn't want to. I really, I'm not going to talk about the epilogue kind of chapter, but it's. It's really good. I liked how the book ended. It's a really,
The choice she decides to make.
The choice she makes at the end.
Which isn't easy and isn't simple.
It's a really, really good ending. And actually it's funny because I read this book as an ebook. So I'm kind of every so often like pressing the bottom of my screen and just pulling up the status bar and seeing how much I've got to
go. Do you know what I do? I mathematically calculate what page I'm on based on the real page number of the book.
Okay.
I do.
Anyway, so, and I noticed I still had like 30 or something pages to go. I was, and I didn't realize that my e-copy has two short stories that were the winner of the Moxieland competition.
Well, this does too, doesn't it?
I don't know if it may do. But I didn't realize that was in the e-book. And so I'm thinking which I know now was actually right at the very end, but I'm thinking there's still like 50 pages to go. Wow. How long is she? And then it kind of just ended. And I went to the next page and it was, you know, other stuff. And I was like, oh, that was the end. Oh, that's awesome. Because it felt like a natural ending point, but I was worried by what I thought were another 40
pages.
My
better ebook application actually told me that there was a separate bit. So I knew that the book ended on page 1354, which was only page 1354 because of the font size I chose. But then I mathematically worked out that 1354, how that 1354 works in terms of page. So if I was on page 921, I could work out in my head what actual page I was in terms of the real physical book. People want to know how I do that. I'll give them the algorithm.
That's fine.
From my brain.
We can put that into the ebook podcast.
Yeah.
This is getting to be such a good idea.
It's been the longest podcast we've ever done, and only on two books.
But we've been talking about. See, well, this is it's quite long. It's almost 2 hours. Oh dear,
Jonathan's going to cry.
But I think this just goes to show when you have two books that are good books and are about stuff that's interesting that you want to talk about.
I still think Karen Lord's going to say, you spoke 4 minutes on my actual book and the rest was on whatever rant you had, which wasn't bad about the book. But
this is what books do.
Books
inspire conversations.
Correct.
And this is why, like sometimes I've said to you, I've read a book that I liked, but I don't want it to be a podcast book because I can't talk for more than 5 minutes about it. And it might be a good book, but it's like I've enjoyed it, but that's about all I can say.
Well, the books we're recommending for – this is the best segue ever. We're recommending for next month are books we will definitely be able to talk about.
Yes.
We are recommending – well, I'm recommending The Silver Wind by Nina Allen, which is a set of five – it says four short stories, but it's actually five short stories. The title story, The Silver Wind, which is one of the short stories in the book, they're all connected as well. Has just been nominated for the BSFA, the British Science Fiction Award. So for best short story, I think it's a corker, this book. If you hate it, I will not talk to you ever again.
Spoilers.
Well, obviously I'm recommending it. I'm recommending it because I really, really loved it. And the book you're recommending is?
Kim Westwood's latest novel, which is The Courier's New Bicycle.
Which, because it's quite new, we'll try
it's
and tone
new-ish.
Down
the spoilers. It's also hard to find outside of Australia because it's only been published in Australia as a print book.
And Kim, I don't want to upset you, but it's actually hard to find in Australia, let alone outside of Australia. In fact, no, but you can buy it online though.
Okay, yeah, because you were talking there was a Google Books version that you
yeah, well,
think was
Fish
great.
Pond or whatever the hell they call it.
Oh yeah, you can buy it online as a yeah. I mean, and you can, but it's not immediately easy to find.
No,
or being an Australian book, particularly inexpensive.
No, it's about 20. if you buy it, this is the shame. If you buy it in a bookstore, it's $24.
Yeah.
If you buy it online, it's $20.
Yeah. Australian which is still
dollars,
quite expensive for a paperback.
Yeah, yes, it's a
not
paperback.
Even a trade; it's just a paperback.
So,
unfortunately, on a global market, that is. I mean, we're used to it in Australia, but on a global marketplace, they become expensive books. But I like the book enough to recommend it. I think there's a lot we're going to be talking about, and I think it's very worth the price of admission.
Now, The Silver Wind, which Kirsten, if you can just take the copy that I gave you, because. Yes, which I bought, is a small press that published it. It's published by Ebonvale, which is www.eibonvalepress.co.uk. But really, just look up The Silver Wind by Nina Allen, which will be in the show. I mean, we'll have a link anyway on the show notes, so you can purchase it for yourself, which is what I did. I bought it pretty. It's on Book Depository, so you know. I'm just saying, you can get
there.
It ain't hard to
you
get.
You can find it.
Yeah, and
so they're the books where. I think that's worth your money.
She, the cat's mother.
I've not read it yet.
No. She, the cat's mother, thinks the Westwood's worth.
Oh
your
yes.
Money. So spend away.
Yes.
So anyway,
spend away. They're both short books too, people.
Yes, we're trying to do a few more shorter books simply because we're doing the longest books in history. I've ordered my copy of The House of Magics. You will never finish Infinite Jest.
I need to start now, don't I?
Yes. So we're wrapping up.
We are wrapping up.
Send feedback to the website is writerandcritic.bodbean.com. Email. And actually, can we get some feedback, people? I'm feeling a bit lonely.
Ian's feeling a bit feedback.
I know.
Starved.
I know this. And I know. Look, if you just want to say we go on for too long, fine. writerandcritic@gmail.com and 5-star iTunes, anything less, don't bother.
Yes, and send us ebook recommendations, original self-published ebooks that you've read and enjoyed and think we'd like to talk about for 10 to 15 minutes, because if we're going to do 4 or 6 books, we'll make them much shorter reviews.
Yes.
So that's about it. Send us recommendations, send us feedback, tell us you love us, tell us you hate us.
And we'll see you on the flip side.
Bye.
I always wanted to say that. Bye.
Bye.
This elephant at the zoo.